How about those Giants?
Try that card.
So I'm picking batters that are playing against the Giants. They're going to get hits.
Great. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the May 23, 2019 Delta Stewardship Council meeting. Let's establish a quorum. Starting with Ken Weinberg on my right.
Weinberg present.
D'Amaro present.
Gatto present.
Maronian present.
Fiorini here.
Tatayan here.
Villegas present.
And we have a quorum. A couple of small changes to the agenda. Due to scheduling conflicts, our legislative report will be presented immediately after the five-year review workshop. And also we will not be having a closed session this afternoon. So with that, let's kick off our five-year review workshop.
Okay, great. Good morning. I'll invite up staff and then I'll say a few words of introduction. Having a statutory requirement for a five-year review of the Delta Plan is a really healthy thing. The experience has allowed reflection on the successes and the challenges of plan implementation, and it's driven some productive conversations, including the recent council retreat, in which we discussed how, as an agency, we can increase the success of our endeavors and spend the next 5 years improving outcomes for the Delta and those who rely upon it. Of course, we know without yet the benefit of years of data for our new performance measures that the Delta stats are still not good. Trajectories for listed species are not good, and recent wet years only provide temporary reprieves for the pain that drought inflicts. Flood risk remains a concern, and compounding climate change impacts loom on the horizon. But there is definitely reason for optimism. Innovation in practices and renewed collaboration across stakeholders and agencies in the Delta offer a lot of hope. The state's nascent Delta Plan, only 6 years old, is having an impact. Our review concludes that the plan is becoming increasingly implemented and institutionalized, with the last 2 years showing a sharp uptick in Delta Plan compliance, and our appeals process has been tested twice. We see our recommendations taking hold and beginning to shape policy actions. So today we'll share draft findings and recommendations and ask for your feedback. The policy areas for future focus come directly from the council retreat discussions, and other implementation focus areas that you see in the packet reflect matters raised both by stakeholders and also by members at the retreat and in recent council meeting discussions. So today we'd like your direction on the preliminary recommendations and especially the policy areas that we've identified. And based on that, in August, we'll come back with additional detail and to get further direction and prioritization from input from you in order to prepare a final report by the end of the year and course-setting direction for the next 5 years of implementation as an agency. So with that, I'll turn it over to our Deputy for Planning, Jeff Henderson.
I will in turn turn it over to our Assistant Planning Director, Harriet Ross.
Good morning, Chair Tatayan and members of the Council. I'm Harriet Ross, Assistant Planning Director. With me today, we also have Andrew Schwartz, Supervisor Engineer, and together we'll be presenting to you the five-year review. So today, we'll be providing an update on the Delta Plan five-year review, as well as the progress we've made since March when we spoke to you last. We'll be presenting the staff findings and recommendations, and we'll also be seeking council feedback on those findings and recommendations. So there really are three main objectives for the five-year review. One is to reflect on the successes and challenges of the initial efforts in the first 5 years of plan implementation.
Excuse me. Sounds like we have
the microphone's not working for you.
Oh.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh.
That's important.
Do I need to start over?
No, you can start over.
Secondly, the objective is to focus and prioritize the council's near-term efforts to implement the plan. And lastly, is to identify planning topics and emerging issues that may inform future plan updates. So we have undertaken an extensive review of the Delta plan over the course of the last 15 months. This includes internal council staff assessments that's shown in the blue circles in the graphic, as well as we've solicited input from outside agencies and stakeholders, and that's shown in the light blue circles. And of course, we've received input from all of you, the council members, at two past council meetings, as well as at the council retreat. So specifically, staff has done a chapter-by-chapter review of the Delta Plan, as well as our sister agencies. We've also performed an assessment on the Delta Plan implementation efforts, and that includes taking a deep dive and looking at our administrative performance measures to determine what has been completed, what is in progress, what still needs to be implemented. We've also done an assessment of our covered actions process and taken those lessons learned from this recent appeals, and those have informed our findings and recommendations. And again, we had an external evaluation of the plan where we interviewed stakeholders, focus groups, all representing a wide variety of Delta interests, as well as sending out surveys to Delta individuals. We also sent a survey to the DPIC, and there are performance measures that are implemented by outside agencies, so we received a status of implementation of those measures. And then the outcome of this five-year review are really two companion reports. First is the highlights report, and that identifies the significant accomplishments for the first 5 years and policy and management challenges for the next 5 to 10 years. And the second outcome is the recommendations report, and that's what Jessica was mentioning, that we'll be bringing back to you a draft in August, and that is really the focus of our discussion today. And that recommendations report will describe the results of the five-year review, the successes, and opportunities for changes of the Delta plan. It will also help us identify those implementation focus for the next 5 years. So in conducting a review of the Delta plan, it's important to consider the original development and evolution of the plan itself. As you all know, the Delta plan was adopted in 2013. It was developed over 3 years with extensive public and interagency input. And since then, we've had 5 amendments. In 2016, we updated the performance measures. We removed the sunset clause exempting single-year water transfers from certification of the consistency requirements. And in 2018, we amended the plan to include the Delta Levy investment strategy, refined some performance measures, and added in recommendations for CSO. And currently in 2019, the council is considering potential amendments to Chapter 4 ecosystem. All of these amendments together give you the Delta plan we have today. So a large amount of staff time has been spent updating and amending the plan in the last few years. And the result is through these amendments, many of the substantive changes that could be identified through a five-year review process have already been completed or are currently underway. So through this five-year review process and input we received, we will be presenting staff findings and recommendations to you today. And with that, I'm going to be turning it over to Andrew Schwartz.
Thanks, Harriet. Chair Tatayan, council members, it's a pleasure to be back with you. So I'll be taking you through the staff, back up one slide, staff findings and recommendations. And we've really structured our findings and recommendations into one overall finding and accompanying recommendation, and then multiple specific findings and recommendations that reinforce this overall finding and talk about how we think we can move forward to achieve the goals of this, the Delta plan. Just to reiterate, we're hoping to hear feedback from you all today, specifically on the recommendations that we're bringing forward, whether those are responsive to the findings that we're going to present to you, and whether you have additions alternatives to those recommendations that you think we should evaluate or consider. Also, as an overall package, we've provided a complete list of findings and recommendations in the staff report, but this information is pretty dense. And there's a lot of analysis and context and backup that we have that's not necessarily included in this presentation. So I'll be pausing throughout to give you an opportunity to ask questions or clarification or provide your feedback. So if you're interested in more information on any of the issues, please ask. All right, so moving into our findings, our overall finding is that the Delta Plan is effective as an enforceable management plan for the Delta, and that implementation is accelerating and shows significant progress toward achieving the co-equal goals. But I think we would all recognize that many challenges still remain. So backing up, kind of how did we get to that finding? When we look at the administrative actions that were recommended in the Delta Plan, over 40%, in fact, almost 50% of those actions are being implemented. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. We find that DPIC is functioning well and is currently even considering an increase in its meeting frequency and kind of an expansion of its purview and things that it's taking on. It's hosted a science enterprise workshop, which laid the groundwork for discussions regarding science funding and governance, and has endorsed high-impact science action and the science action agenda. We also find that the plan contains the core elements and a strong regulatory framework for furthering the co-equal goals. The amendments that Harriet talked about just a moment ago really complete all the commitments that were made in the original plan to make revisions to the plan and bring the plan into alignment with state initiatives and priorities at this time. We also find that regulatory certainty is a really important part of continued implementation, and that the plan needs additional time to work. 5 years is not a very long period of time to expect a plan this complex and a system this complex to change course. Staff, I did identify in their review of the plan some out-of-date references, facts and figures, and some newer challenges that are not completely aligned with our evolving understanding of these challenges. But none of these pose a significant barrier to implementation at this time. And we've developed some recommendations relating to these evolving issues that I'll talk about in a moment. We do find that there's still some confusion and misconception about the plan and its contents. There are stakeholders that are not familiar with important elements of the plan. And so communication will be a continued important aspect of how we move forward. So our overall conclusion, the Delta Plan review, is that the Delta Plan in its current form, including the amendments and ongoing consideration of amendments, is effective in guiding the actions of local and state agencies and does not require any immediate significant changes to ensure successful implementation. We're recommending that implementation activities over the next 5 years focus, staff activities over the next 5 years focus on implementation-specific activities, and that we maintain a stable and consistent plan and regulatory framework to help with the sustained implementation activities that we need, and that we focus on communication with partner agencies and stakeholders in everything that we do. And I think you'll see that as I move through the specific recommendations and talking about how communications works in each of those areas. So I think there I will pause and just open it up to any questions that you might have about what I've just presented.
There we go. All right. So thank you, Andrew, for the presentation. So in terms of the overall findings of the confusion and misconceptions about what the plan entails, not surprising. I mean, it's a monster plan. There's a lot in there. So The notion of asking somebody or key stakeholders if they understand it or if they're aware of it oftentimes only is applicable if there's an issue that's you're trying to resolve, or there's so in general it's easy to say yes, it's a great plan and I'm sure there's a lot of good stuff in there, but I'm not totally surprised that that's a finding. I guess my question is, who are the folks that you've identified that you reference that are still confused or unaware? Because stakeholders in general who may not be totally familiar with it is one thing, but if there are key stakeholders who should be aware and that the element of surprise could be detrimental to implementing aspects of the plan, it would seem to me that'd be something we would want to work on, and that the five-year review is a perfect opportunity to kind of maybe tweak how we may want to address that in whatever way. So I'm curious as to who those folks are that you referenced as a...
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. Those, I would say that those stakeholders span the gamut, okay. And including key stakeholders that really should know a little bit more in detail. A lot of the stakeholders know the parts of the plan that specifically relate to their activities, but then are less familiar with the other parts of the plan and may be making assumptions about what's in the plan that are erroneous because they're not familiar with it, so they think something is not included in the plan. So, I think we saw that from the individual residents of the Delta that predominantly responded to the survey, and we also saw it in our interviews and focus groups that we talked to with key stakeholders in the Delta that we might have thought would have had a better handle on what's in the plan.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Your presentation. I mean, are you going to address those specifics? Good. Okay.
Yep. Perfect segue. So I'll move into some of the specific findings and recommendations that are necessary to implement the overall recommendation and kind of back up that overall finding. We hope that you'll find these recommendations as appropriate responses to the analysis we've conducted, and that the findings we've made and the suite of activities that we're recommending work together to cover all the major areas that are important to the council. Again, we're looking for your feedback on additional areas that you'd like to see analyzed or alternatives to the recommendations that we're putting forward. So our first group of recommendations backs up this finding and recommendation that we want to focus on implementation. There are seven recommendations here. Strengthen plan implementation really means focusing staff resources on implementing our existing policies and regulations and recommendations. This is really about enforcing our regulations and supporting project proponents through collaborative efforts. So the Delta Plan policies are primarily implemented through the covered action process. That's kind of one leg of the stool. The recommendations, another leg of the stool, are primarily implemented by the council and other state agencies, and these are more voluntary. We don't have a stick to enforce these. And then the third leg of the stool is our performance measures, and they're really how we the metric that we use to measure implementation of the policies and recommendations and how we're doing. And so if you look at this list of implementation categories, you'll see that it's structured around those four legs of the stool. Three legs of the stool. All right.
That's a chair.
Yeah, it's a chair. That would be a chair. Exactly. Okay. Diving in a little bit more detail on the covered action process and our regulations, this graph is showing covered actions over time, or certifications of covered actions over time, starting with the implementation of the plan and finishing up at the end of 2018, where we kind of drew the line in the sand for this analysis. There have been 18 in total, and you can see about 70% of those have occurred in the last 2 years, so a steep uptick. We've also administrated 10 appeals, covered action appeals, and all 10 of those on two projects have occurred in the last 12 months. This is a clear acceleration of implementation efforts and acceptance of the council's authority. and also an associated increase on staff demands in this area of plan implementation. This increase goes along with hundreds of comment letters that staff send to project proponents, and also on state grant guidelines to make sure that they're referencing Delta Plan recommendations and policies, and dozens of early consultation meetings that happen in a lot of different forums and formats. All these activities have resulted in better outcomes on the ground, which means projects are consistent with the Delta Plan. Drilling down a little bit more to give you some background into the covered action. This is a pie chart just showing what those certifications, what types of projects have certified. If you're really quick at math, this adds up to more than 18, and that's just because projects often have multi-purposes and check multiple boxes. But it's clear that ecosystem projects are the lion's share of what we've seen in the first 5 years of the plan. So moving on to some specific findings on covered actions, focusing on outreach, early consultation, and our administrative procedures. In general, we find that the council's covered action process is working well and showing significant year-on-year improvement in compliance and quality. It's leading to better outcomes in the Delta, and which are including greater transparency and communication among stakeholders and project proponents. And we do find that our regulatory process is unique, and it's taken some time for the regulated community to understand how it works and what compliance means. In the early days, there were some project proponents that resisted or misunderstood our consistency requirements, and even a few important projects went through to implementation without certifying consistency with the Delta Plan. But we just don't see that today anymore. And we also see that the level of knowledge and understanding that project proponents come to us today for early consultation is much higher and much more in tune with where we'd like them to be coming into the process. And they're seeking us out as opposed to us having to bang down their doors to consult with them. All evidence that things are working. Council investments in outreach and early consultation have shown significant progress. And are increasing the certifications and appeals. The other thing we found is that the council has administrative procedures for appeals that were written in 2010, prior to having us ever seen a covered action or an appeal. And now with the experience of 5 years, we think it may be appropriate to review those procedures, those administrative procedures for appeals, to look at what, if anything, might be able to be improved. We think that particularly there may be ways to improve the process for to provide more communication and exchange of information between stakeholders and project proponents to resolve differences earlier in the process and to get more information out into the public sphere. And finally, we want to use council communication with the public and project proponents. On repetition. Anyway, our recommendation on these issues is really to review the administrative procedures and identify what, if anything, needs to be changed. But we're not recommending any significant changes to early consultation or covered action process at this time. We think those are working pretty well. We need to continue to devote significant staff resources and focus to these activities and continue to learn from our experiences as we have throughout the first 5 years. And we're implementing those lessons learned. And we'll talk more about that in the recommendations report. And we need to be more proactive in outreach and communication with project proponents and early consultations. So those are our recommendations with respect to that part of covered actions. And I will pause briefly there. There are any questions or comments on that?
Good report, Andrew, but you're not done. maybe going back to the project type slide, the pie chart, page 14. So the 13 ecosystem projects, does that reflect on the scale, the fact that we had 13, the scale of those projects, and you know, when we're talking in the ecosystem amendment, a scale is important. You know, are these the type of projects that we want to see? Are we, you know, getting to scale on these, or are these the ones that you, there's so many of them because they're not large and they're not at the scale we need to see?
Yeah, I'm certainly no expert on all of our ecosystem projects, but I think, yeah, you could generally characterize these as many of them have been smaller. They're not the massive, the more landscape scale projects that we want to see. And I think you see some, adjustment to the direction of the Delta plan to be responsive to that already and what's being considered in the Chapter 4 amendment.
So as we look out in the future, we want to see not big numbers of projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also important to remember that these projects take a long time to mature and work their way through the development process, right? So these are a lot of projects that were probably being considered and then became projects shortly after the Delta plan was implemented, in order to work their way all the way through the process. And so the system is learning and improving.
Okay. I would also add, there's a lot to unpack in this particular pie chart, but a lot of these have the same project proponent, at least the same Department of Water Resources, for example. And so it certainly helps that once you've done a few covered actions with one proponent, then you start to, you know, they better understand the process, they're more likely to come in earlier, they're more likely to certify. And so I think that's one thing that you're seeing here, in addition to just obviously the focus of the last administration on the Eco Restore initiative. There was a big push to get as many of these projects across the finish line before Governor Brown left office. So that's a reflection in here, too.
Oh, okay. No, just curious. And, you know, that the fact that people have sort of mentally adjusted to the covered action process, that seems to be a big step forward. And you know, that and having that as the trend, and it's having been part of the regulatory community, the regulated community, it takes some mental adjustment to go, gee, I got another place to go to. But it sounds like, you know, people are doing that, and I'm sure it's really because the staff has been so helpful in early consultation. I mean, that's really important to make it as easy as you can, understandable as you can. Thank you.
So I think on that point, one of our general recommendations then is it would be nice to allow more time for staff to better track and engage in these projects more proactively. And if we're not, if we're doing an amendment, that ends up taking a lot of staff time. And so it's always a trade-off going forward as to how much time we're spending changing the plan, amending the plan, versus kind of being more proactive on things like the covered action process and also implementing the existing recommendations in the plan.
Any other questions? So I have a question, Andrew. What are some of the other factors contributing to the more participation, and what kinds of outreach have been done?
I think we've been diligent in commenting on environmental documents, reaching out to the agencies that are doing projects in the Delta, having feelers out everywhere so we know when a project is coming. I mean, that's one of the big difficulties is really knowing where the projects are and what's coming. And so building connections and relationships with different agencies, knowing the people within those agencies and local government offices that are doing projects that know about the Delta plan and know about our regulations, know about the covered action process, and say, hey, we need to do this. And what we really see is in the early days, some of the resistance was that they hadn't planned for this additional regulatory step in their process. It wasn't in their schedule. It wasn't in their budget. And now it is. They understand that this is another step in the process. We've talked to them about a past project that maybe it was difficult and maybe they did it, maybe they didn't, but now in future projects they get it. they see it as a necessary step and what it's going to take. So we've done that outreach, and that's now kind of starting to pay off, and we want to keep doing that and keep reinforcing that. And Jessica mentioned that there are a few usual suspects, right, that do a lot of projects in the Delta. And so really working with those agencies is important, but also catching all the other little agencies that maybe do one every few years. So that's a heavier lift to get out and talk to all of those agencies as well. All right, moving on to the other major area that we looked at in terms of covered actions, and this is the adaptive management and best available science component. And we find that adaptive management and best available science are now widely used and understood terms. And 5 years ago, these terms were really understood by only a small cadre of scientists and practitioners, and now they're nearly ubiquitous in management and policy discussions. And there is general support for both widely across the field. We find that there's still some frustration with applying the Delta Plan's kind of general adaptive management framework on a project-specific basis, so that downscaling process is still frustrating, and we're working toward that. And projects are struggling still with differing regulatory requirements across different agencies and funding sources. But council staff have already been responsive to that and have been working with other agencies and interagency groups to facilitate coordinated support and guidance for adaptive management. Another interesting finding in this analysis was that the best available science policy, GP1B3 really stood out as one of the most robust and important policies in the entire plan. And the reason for this is it really covers a broad range of project activities beyond the specified policy activities. It applies to every project, and it applies to how they evaluate those specific regulatory policies, but it also can apply to other issues of scientific importance that stakeholders want more information from a project proponent on. So climate change, cyanobacteria are two areas that have come up in past appeals, and if there is substantial evidence and state of the practice supports doing more analysis on a scientific field, then that's something that that can push projects to do a better job of analyzing and considering scientific information. So that was an interesting kind of realization that came out of this. A recommendation with respect to these areas is that collaboration with other agencies to advance our understanding and application of adaptive is to continue collaborating with other agencies to advance our understanding and application of adaptive management, to emphasize customizing adaptive management and early consultations, and really focus on the depth of best available science considerations that projects need to do so that are not taken by surprise by these kinds of broad considerations that best available science can bring in. And then to identify priority areas of interest for future science action agendas and research funding. This is really consistent with what the science action agenda found, but it's the other side of the coin, right? They suggested that science needs to be better tied to the policy, and we're coming at this from the other side, making sure our policy requirements and the science requirements there are better tied to the science action agenda so that we're linking those two things together and really getting the best science that informs our policy decisions. So with that, I will stop again.
Maria?
Yeah.
Did you
two questions. You talked about the understanding of, like, somehow everybody, all the stakeholders and everybody else comes to understand the concept of adaptive management and the best science. Mm-hmm. So there's two parts to this. It's the constituents and the stakeholders, and then it's the other agencies, correct? At least two parts to this. Mm-hmm. So in that scenario, there's, in one case, it's the buy-off. And in one scenario, I mean, it's like for everybody else is to buy off the idea that this is happening. And then for the other agencies is this possibility of collaborating. So I want to know if there is a place, a space where this collaboration gets on the best science, gets regulated or comes together. I mean, what is the body, or should there be a place, a clearinghouse, a pole where all this different science or scientific analysis and research comes together between the agencies, or it's kind of hit and miss? And if it is, what can be done to change it?
So I can address that. So in terms of adaptive management, one thing that we just recently did was the adaptive management workshop that I think was an effort to engage stakeholders, agency staff, and everyone to bring them up to a similar level of understanding and knowledge and to really think about how we do apply that to individual projects. So that was a two-day workshop, and that will be a recurring event that will help to educate everyone about adaptive management. In terms of science, I think the best single thing to think about there is the state of the Bay Delta science. That's our, you know, our review that we do that was done to, let's see, 3 years ago, 2016, to identify the current understanding of issues and to identify areas of uncertainty that links right into the science action agenda. So I think those, and then the ongoing science conference as well brings in all the players in terms of the current state of the science, the really up-to-date understanding.
Who are the possible or more likely agencies that come into play in collaborating on best science?
All of the participants in DPIC, I mean, all of the state and federal agencies, as well as the universities and NGOs as well, are all really participating.
So you're comfortable with the idea of how much collaboration it is on putting together resources that does best science research for everybody that is involved, or no?
Well, I mean, I think we need to keep working on that sort of outreach. But I think in terms, so I wasn't involved in the science action agenda, but I know that was very thoroughly reviewed, and there was significant input on that. The science plan that was just endorsed and that soon will be printed and available for you also went through very significant outreach. So I think we are definitely trying hard to reach those appropriate constituents, whether it's agency staff or NGOs.
Can you think of like a success story in your mind that happened? The reason I'm asking this is because I'm thinking that the buy-off and the moving of the needle would be so much easier if people agreed that that's the best science. You know? So are there things that you would say?
I think what we talked about recently with the Delta Smelt Resiliency Plan is a good example of how, people came together to identify what are the current uncertainties, where do we need to work, and then similarly the Salmon Resiliency Plan, I think, were both examples where the community came together to identify those issues. Mm-hmm. I think we need to keep doing that more. I mean, one of the key recommendations in the science plan is to identify, improve our topic-specific science plans and really come together around issues and identify those key management questions and link those up to science directly. And that's something that the DPIC Science Initiative is also thinking about. So I think we're aware of that, and we're trying hard to address that.
And one last question. Do you think that there is a space for us to exert ourselves in that? Or will we, or can we?
I think we do. So I think the science plan, I mean, I think we are definitely pushing to coordinate the science, and that's the science program's role. And I think I think the adoption of the Science Action Agenda as the priority for research topics, not just for us, but for the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, for USBR. I think that reflects that people are responding to that and incorporating it.
Sure.
So I think, I think, of course, there's room for improvement, but I think we are getting traction.
That $10 million that you endorsed in terms of research investment would not have happened if the Delta Science plan had not occurred and if the high-impact science actions had not occurred. So I think it's the fruit of these collaborative efforts. I think even during the CalFed era, there was certainly a science program and a science board at that time. But I mean, from the people I've talked to, there's never been as much collaboration on that topic as there is today.
Thank you. Mike?
Yeah, so I have an observation, and I wish I had a solution, but I don't. So I think that I understand what best available science is. I think you understand. I think the agencies understand. I think the interest groups understand. But I don't think the people understand. I don't think the public understands what best available science is. I base that on years of observations and conversations with them. There's a lot of cynicism. That's my observation. There's a tremendous amount of cynicism about what best available science is. Some of that could be due to the term itself. Obviously, the word best is subjective, right? I mean, the term itself has a, whenever you, you know, if you ask, if you went around this dais and asked everybody who was the best darn council member, there'd be six opinions, not seven. But you see, I mean, like it's not just that though. It's that the public is just deeply cynical about this, and that is palpable in every conversation that I've had. And so I don't know. I don't know what we can do to get them to feel better. Like I said, I wish I had a solution. We live in a very, very cynical world. I think a lot of the public, I mean, they've said this on the microphone. They say it even louder behind closed doors and in emails and things like that. They say that, you know, that the science is, you know, that if you took two or three different scientists, which is sometimes the case, and you'd have such profound differences of opinion, even on, you know, some issues that we would think would be more or less decided or, you know, where there is a rather objectively agreed upon, you know, answer. So it's difficult, and I just wonder, I give it to everybody. I know I've said this before, probably not in so many words before, and so I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. I think we're all very mindful of what this is. We understand it very well, but I think the public doesn't, and I wonder what we could do, or maybe it's just a call to everybody as we do our business to make sure that the public understands how much time goes into it, how much effort, you know, and try to get them comfortable, and I'm not sure they ever will be. There's people who will always doubt why science is used for a particular agenda, and I also think on that note, you know, I think Maria alluded to this, we have to be very clear. Science informs policymaking. Policymaking, though, is by definition, it is a subjective exercise in discretion. And the two are, you know, you hope to be linked. You hope you can say we based our vote or our answer on the first one. But they're not always linked. We've talked about this before. There could be something that science says is clearly going on, but we might still choose a different policy outcome. So those are my observations, and it's just really more of a call to everybody involved.
I think that's an astute observation, and I think one of the our last recommendation on staff development and technological development might start to get at some of that, and maybe think about how we can talk a little bit more about that too. There.
Oh.
You go first. Right?
Well, yeah, my question is really goes back to DPIC and the collaboration with federal agencies in particular. Do you see the same type of collaboration, understanding of the Delta Plan among the federal agencies and issues that we confront as you do with the state agencies? Is that a particular problem, or is that another?
I guess it's a long, yeah. It depends what federal agency I think you're talking about, right? We've had better coordination and cooperation with some versus another. And actually, we have a recommendation further on down related to federal participation and coordination, where we tease out some of those issues
I suppose policy informs that type of position, that obviously. And it's been a pretty. You're telling us there's an increasing sense of collaboration and cooperation and understanding of the Delta Plan, but that may not extend to everybody. That sometimes are very key players
yep.
in the Delta Plan. Maybe this, you're going to address that later on, but it seems to me that's a sobering thought. If you're dealing with that problem, and sometimes it's not beyond our reach and beyond our ability to make a difference in their thinking. Are you going to make any recommendations specifically about that kind of conflict that may exist?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm wait for that.
Ken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm glad that we have this agendized as a workshop, because these are like really important issues. And also, you know, there's some overlap, and I think staff mentioned it with the council retreat. And, you know, when we were prioritizing, we raised issues that had to do with the five-year review. You know, covered actions, you know, from this last year, we've seen how essential it is to the functioning of the council. And I like the fact that staff recommended trying to bring the council in and educate us on these actions earlier. One of the lessons learned, and I know we've talked about having more discussions on lessons learned, is that, you know, it seems like we've tried to strike this balance between not being too prescriptive, but then being specific enough so that the regulated community can respond, and using early consultation to kind of help them do that. But I think one thing I noticed, and I've heard from others, is given the appeals process, that seems to drive us to specificity. And, you know, the more objective standards we can have, the more we can communicate, it seems, for both the applicants or the covered action community and the public, everybody will have more certainty about, well, what is it that drives consistency? And so, you know, to adaptive management and best available science, I would add reduced reliance on the Delta and the mitigation. I think in the Smith Canal thing, we had a lot of discussion about mitigation and, you know, if mitigation is adopted in CEQA, is that our standard? Are we going to ask for more than that? On reduced reliance, I think there are legislatively mandated standards that fit what we're trying to accomplish, or we can tweak them. You know, can we do the same in adaptive management? The more sort of it's, you know, up for interpretation, it makes it difficult in a regulatory environment. You know, it's not like, okay, you need to hit X milligrams per liter and you've complied with the regulation. We don't want to be that prescriptive, but I think we need to maybe think about moving a little more to more specificity, more clarity for the applicants, and how we do that, you know, whether we can do that administratively. I know there's a limit to what we can do. Or I wouldn't want to take the regulatory part off the table in this review if that's going to help us with both the stakeholders and the regulated community by being more specific. I have something specific in mind for reduced reliance that at some point I'd like to propose to the council. On these other things, I think this is stuff that maybe, you know, we can work on to be more specific and clear in how we communicate. So that's, you know, that's something. I think these recommendations are good and moves us in the right direction, but I don't know that that gets to specificity and communication, which, you know, as Mike kind of you've brought up on several occasions, that's an important thing for the public to understand what we're trying to accomplish, but also how we're trying to accomplish it. And if we have to make decisions, it's clear that, hey, you know, these are the standards. We've discussed this. There was a process for input, and this is clarity for everybody, how we make our decisions. So, and it's understandable. It's just like people just getting their heads around coming to us for covered actions, it's going to take time to go from the first plan to say, okay, did we kind of hit the right spot here? So, I mean, I'm curious about how others think, but that was a big lesson I took out of these covered actions. It's just the need to be more specific. And the appeals process, because is it quasi-legal or it's a legal process?
It's quasi-judicial.
It's quasi-judicial. I mean, it drives us to, gee, we've got to be really specific, and that's the wrong time to have to be specific. It is during appeals. We need to kind of get there earlier on. So that's something I'd like, you know, I would propose that we try and focus on in the covered action process and adding reduced reliance and mitigation to that.
If I can just make one comment to that, and this isn't a disagreement with you, the benefit of the appeals process, though, just to plant the seed, is that you then adopt precedential decisions that offer clarity on your interpretation of the regulations. So the Smith Canal determination that this board adopted, now it won't offer clarifying on WRP1, but on the policies that were implicated, covered action proponents and staff can now look to that in early consultation to tell project proponents how you will interpret or how you have interpreted, for example, ERP3, ERP5 mitigation measures in the past. So as the council matures, we will have that body of decisions by you aiding us as well. So you can certainly, it's your prerogative to look at the policies and the recommendations for amendment, but also keep in mind that those are precedential decisions as well, that it's a body of work the council will be building as well.
So how do those precedents come back into formal guidance to applicants?
They are sitting there as precedential decisions. So when a project proponent, I shouldn't say they, there's one, it is sitting there as a precedential decision right now. So if there are questions that are similar or identical that are raised on GP1B2 issues on mitigation or ERP3, ERP5, the issues that came up on Smith Canal, they are now guidance to staff and covered action proponents on how to be structuring their CEQA documents, what substantial evidence looks like here to the council on those issues, and then helps us as staff guide them through the early consultation process, and then helps guide you in future bodies for how you're looking at those issues, those particular issues, as a project comes to you on appeal.
That's a painful process.
I agree with you that it's after the fact that you want to be there earlier.
No, but it's important, and you said something important about they know how to structure their CEQA documents. One of the lessons I took out of Smith Canal is we need to get into those documents. People need to start writing about these things in their documents, and we need to be at the scoping meetings, need to convince them. You know, when they're looking at other plans and in their EIRs and the permits, I mean, they've got to really, we need to help them. We need to help them, give them language to earlier,
the emphasis on early and early consultation has been something that I think the more time staff have on implementation, the better we can get at that. Ideally, you're in at the ground floor, at the scoping meetings, presenting on the Delta plan and its requirements so that a certain amount of analysis can be included in the CEQA document to ease their compliance with the Delta plan.
And this gets back to communication and how we communicate that or how we communicate what the precedential, outcomes of appeals, how do we get that out to people? And that just gets to this point of, gee, we need to be more specific. What is our latitude in the council interpreting what is consistency in these areas and communicating that versus, gee, we have to put that in a revised regulation? I don't know what that standard is, but it's something, we need to talk about, I think, at least from my perspective, just to give everybody better clarity so they're not surprised at decisions that we have to make or or use the appellate process solely as a way to clarify.
Great. I think that's going to be an ongoing conversation. I think with more experience, we'll learn our latitude as well as discover our boundaries. So I am wondering, though, is there, when you say guidance, Ken, are you thinking of a sort of a guidebook, or what kind of guidance? In addition to early consultations, something that we would offer? Or
just, you know, council policies. I don't know either how you do it, but it's like, yeah. Okay, here's what we're looking for, you know, to be consistent with the mitigation policies.
Mm-hmm.
And, gee, you really need, when you adopt your mitigation measures and your plan, you need to get this in there worded something like this, and then we won't have a problem. Then you know when you come in you've been consistent, because if they're coming in after their environmental document and we're looking at CEQA-type standards, mm-hmm. you know, it's too much interpretation potentially. I don't know. That's why I just think it's an issue that's worth us kind of diving into. And then again, back to the council retreat and our priorities, you know, this is all sort of mixed in there, whole lessons learned, and, you know, what do we, you know, how do we respond proactively to the lessons that we learned?
Mm-hmm. At the risk of belaboring that point, I think that's why you see reduced reliance keeps popping up as one of the important implementation areas moving forward. A key challenge when we had our first set of appeals was that the recommendations that were associated with the regulation on reduced reliance hadn't been fully implemented. And so what essentially we were calling for the adoption of a standardized reporting mechanism that unfortunately didn't exist when WaterFix came to us. And so I think there's a lot of room to talk about that when we start diving deeper.
Yeah, and that's structural changes to make implementation easier and clearer is really, you know, I think a priority for us at some place we can put council energy into. Because that urban water management plan issue is an easy fix. But it's going to need legislation to do it.
Okay.
Well, that's onward. Probably a good segue into our next section, which focuses on the performance measures in the plan. So these, again, are used to measure implementation of the Delta Plan. We have three different types of performance measures. There are 145 administrative performance measures, and these really track implementation of Delta Plan recommendations and policies. And then there are 32 outcome outperformance measures that track on-the-ground implementation of management actions and system responses. So digging into those administrative performance measures and how we're doing, if we look at this graph, the top section, that green 17%, are complete. So those are success stories. 29% are progressing on schedule or are ongoing and will really never be complete. We'll have to continue to implement those over time. So that's 46% total, almost a half of all of the administrative actions. I think that's a good success story. We have about 18% that are out of date. Those mostly relate to administrative or recommendations that have been superseded by new state initiatives or laws. So we had a number of recommendations related to groundwater management and tracking. With the implementation or the adoption of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in 2014, the state really implemented a much more regulatory and defined system for tracking and managing groundwater throughout the state than anything that the recommendations in the Delta Plan had envisioned. And so those recommendations are kind of out of date now with what SGMA is requiring, not really a focus of what we want to look at going forward. And then we have about 8% that are progressing but are behind schedule. An interesting example of this is the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. So the Delta Plan called for that to be updated in 2014. As we all know, that's still an ongoing discussion. It's uber complex and has a lot of moving parts and pieces. But it is certainly moving forward. It's just it hasn't met the timeline that was established in the plan. And then the red area, the 28% that are showing very little progress toward implementation. And then we have a number of new recommendations that came out of the amendments to Chapters 3 and 7 that just haven't had a lot of time to work, and we probably need to focus on getting those going as well. And I think some of the recommendations that haven't shown any or nearly enough progress, Ken, are responsive to your reduced reliance concerns there, and we'll walk through those in just a moment. Super quickly, don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but we do have these output performance metrics. They were just adopted in April. There's 32 of them, and they provide information for long-term performance. We think these are going to be super useful in the future for informing future iterations of the five-year plan, maybe the 10-year or the 15-year. But really, these are so new that we, for many of them, we have a single data point of reported information on these. And so they just don't provide trajectory or a good status information yet. But we have, we think these hold a lot of promise, and we're not recommending any changes to these at this time. Our finding with respect to performance measures really focuses in on that red and orange section of the pie chart there. We find that efforts by the council and other agencies to implement the Delta Plan recommendations and achieve the administrative performance measures have been successful in part, but have not been fully realized. There's still almost a third that need more work. And as we focus in on these red areas, we've identified these five areas of which there are multiple recommendations in each that are priority areas that we think we can further focus our attention. And this really represents a little bit of a change, a policy change in how we allocate our time around here. This is, we have not heretofore spent a ton of time reinforcing recommendations and talking to agencies about recommendations. And so this is really identifying some specific recommendations that we think are really important and some areas that they attach to, and focusing in on developing specific strategies for engaging and collaborating with implementing agencies for these recommendations. So really going out and talking to DWR about what needs to be done with respect to reducing reliance on the Delta and complying with those recommendations to get that done. To link DPIC agenda items to Delta Plan implementation activities and those recommendations, and to hold folks accountable and to be reporting on these and to be talking about them and communicating on how they're important and why. And we can use these output outcome performance measures that kind of track the implementation of some of these things as data points of how we're progressing. We have an output performance measure for how many urban water management plans incorporate this reduced reliance metric. We right now only have one data point on how many there are, and over time we'll have more, and hopefully we'll be seeing that number spike. And we want to build on the tracking that we're already doing with these measures in our online dashboard to establish specific schedules and status and progress updates. So we're continuously checking in with agencies about how things are going, why aren't they progressing, what do we need to do to make things happen faster, and improve staff engagement with partner agencies and report progress regularly to you all in these meetings and in other public forums. So we're raising the profile of these recommendations and talking about them and making them more understandable to the public and why they're important. I think I'll stop there again.
Ken.
I just want to clarify the, you know, Andrew commented on the urban water management plans. Only one is dealing with reduced reliance, but really most of them are because they have to. So right. When they're analyzing conservation or local supplies, and I know the ones in Southern California, it's all about reduced reliance. It's just not specifically, they didn't put it under a section and they didn't really, you know, put the data as a way that would be most helpful. And that's really why I said the fix is pretty easy. It's just tell them how you want to see it.
Right.
And, you know, again, the clarity. But the work is being done out there. It's just yes. Nobody is looking at it specifically from our perspective. They're looking at it as diversifying their water supply or being water efficient. We all get to the same place. It's just we need to say, hey, you make everybody's life easier if you organize it this way. And maybe why don't you analyze something that helps us.
Just following up on that, Ken. If that's true, I mean, is there a way that the staff could really reclassify and reorganize that reporting requirement? That's pretty critical, I would think.
So it is a key recommendation in the Delta Plan, and one of the recommendations we've identified is okay. Putting more resources towards. But I think to clarify your point, you didn't mean one data point as in one urban water management plan.
Correct.
You meant one
correct,
reporting deadline of all the urban water management plans is the
okay,
data
so
set
the
that we're sifting through. Yes.
Right, exactly. So in 2015, we only can evaluate these things as they're updated, right? So in 2015, we evaluated it, and we'll do it again in 2020. Just to respond to what you're saying there, and I think, so DWR did, one of the recommendations that is completed is DWR did update and establish guidelines for what a reduced reliance element in an urban water management plan would include. So that actually is one of the completed recommendations. It is voluntary to include that element. And so,
which is the point of, you know, and Mike can probably remember, it's almost annually there's some legislation on, oh, do this in your urban water management plan or do that and do it by a certain date. So, you know, simplistically, DWR can say, put it in the guidebook and just say, do it, and here's how we want you to do it. Or, you know, what it's just, it's again, it's back to communicating. You know, what is it that we want? And, you know, water agencies typically go, okay, well, I can do that in my urban water management plan. And that legislation is usually very non-controversial. Or DWR can just put it in the guidebook. We can work with them on how we want to see it. And everybody opens their guidebook and gives them what they want. So, you know, again, it's just how you communicate and just tell us what it is you want and don't make it crazy and overburdensome, but, you know, that's how we'll get the data that we need and have people address it. And I think they are addressing it, but nobody's looking at it, and I've had this conversation with Jessica, nobody's looking at it from our perspective. They're looking at it from, I need to be more reliable, I need to diversify, I need to be more water efficient, and we just right. need to get them thinking like we do, or at least helping us.
I think this discussion is really useful to illustrate the types of more specific strategies that we want to develop and discuss in August. So this is one example. It's kind of like, okay, what's the next step to make this recommendation implemented? Are there barriers? What are those barriers? Are they legislative barriers? Are they, you know, financial barriers, et cetera, and really hammering home until we get to implementation to better support compliance with the Delta Plan.
Thanks for indulging me in the urban water management plan. Riff.
Go ahead, Harriet.
All right. that brings us to our final implementation, strength and implementation recommendation and finding, staff development and technological advancement. And this is really aimed at keeping us at pace and ahead of the state of the practice and to make us a model in state government, resource management, and policy decision making. Here again, we're contemplating a bit of a shift from our existing practice and focusing in on using some of these tools and developing developing staff. We find that technology like rich monitoring data sets, sophisticated modeling, and GIS increasingly drive best available science, adaptive management and policy decisions, and management actions. An example of this is the recently updated Delta Plan output outcome performance measures, where they really pull together a lot of data and analytics and then use state-of-the-art website development tools to display and communicate all of those, all of that complex information to the public in a way that's understandable and gets to the point of why is this important with different layers of drilling down for different audiences, and we want to continue to build on that. Sophisticated deployment of new tools and analytical approaches, we think, can benefit the Council's implementation activities, not just in communication, but in better information for you all to make decisions on and better analytics. And I think this is being borne out in the work that's being done on the ecosystem amendment, and I think will also play into the climate change vulnerability assessment as well and other activities. A recommendation is to focus resources and efforts on the development of staff capacity, expertise, and IT infrastructure improvements over the next 5 years, and deploy new analytical tools to support management and policy decisions and the communication of those decisions to the public.
So, Andrew, I have a question on the new analytical tools. Could you give some examples of what those tools might be?
Sure. So, yeah. Well, certainly, I mean, there's just more and more and more that can be done with GIS and with scripting and coding, so you can automate things in GIS to do things automatically and quickly for large data sets. Programming languages like R that are open source, we don't have to pay any licensing fee, and we can do a lot of analysis. You can actually construct models, simple models, using these tools. I think another really good example, a few days ago, DWR released their climate change vulnerability assessment, and they used a tool called a story map to kind of present and display that information to the public in a way that's just really, really salient and clear and interesting and interactive. You can kind of drill in and you can move around and you can, and so I think those types of tools, I think, can really expand our message and first contribute to making good policy decisions and doing detailed analysis that we don't always have to be asking DWR or the Water Board or whoever else or our consultants to do everything for us, but also to convey that information to the public in interesting and you all and other forums in interesting ways and that resonates with people.
Mm-hmm. So more visualization and data tracking visually and user-friendly front-end interface.
Yeah, and it's the no ability to the technical savvy and the capacity both in staff resources and in servers and hardware and those kinds of things to be able to and licenses and you know whatever you need to be able to deploy these tools when they're needed. The appropriate tool, having a large toolbox. You know, I have a great workshop in my garage, you know, with lots of tools. And, you pick the right tool for the job, because if you don't have a big set of tools, you end up using the same tool over and over again. It might not be the best tool for the mm-hmm. job.
Okay. Thank you.
And you got bicycles in your garage.
I got a couple of bikes in there, too.
I'll get your address.
Later. Yeah.
He's a Twitter star on high school.
Okay.
Okay. All right. So that brings us to the kind of second area of specific recommendations and findings that we identified. These are planning topics and emerging issues. These are areas that have evolved in importance or have emerged since the Delta Plan's original adoption. These topics represent issues that may be becoming increasingly important to Californians, and the depth of treatment or the policy responses in the Delta Plan may not be fully aligned with our current understanding of the issue or the societal importance that is being placed on it these days. Based on analysis of the Delta Plan, stakeholder feedback, recent scientific findings, staff have identified four specific areas that we want to focus on. And in many cases, the council has already begun development of information and studies that help contribute to resolving these issues. And then we find that for each of these four, these could ultimately result in future amendments to the plan. We're not recommending a specific amendment process at this point. We're basically recommending in all of these further investigations to tease out exactly what, if any, amendment is needed and what that might include. Today, I'd just like to lay out these issues. And in the draft recommendation report that we'll be presenting in August, we'll be presenting these in more detail and with more information about level of effort that would be required to do each of these things. And we can have a more detailed discussion in August about which one of these we prioritize first and which ones rise to the top. But today we'd like to get your feedback really on, are these the four most important issues that we should be talking about? And if there are other recommended approaches that we could go about to deal with them. So climate change is the first one. I'm not going to spend much time here. I think we all agree that this is a huge issue. Nearly every stakeholder we talked to identified climate change as an issue of great importance. We did find that the Delta Plan already does include quite a bit of information on climate change and sea level rise, but probably additional steps may need to be taken to advance the co-equal goals in the context of a changing climate. Obviously, the council has already approved and begun a climate change vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy. So what we're recommending is after the completion of that study that we evaluate potential for Delta Plan amendments to address any additional climate change risks and policy responses that might be needed. If there's any questions about that, or we can go through all four, and then we'll talk about them maybe as a group. The second issue is environmental justice in disadvantaged communities. This has really emerged as a statewide priority in the last 5 to 10 years. An example of this is Senate Bill 1000, which was passed in 2016, which now requires all county and local general plans to include an environmental justice element. If you also look at state grant funding programs, generally they include specific carve-outs for disadvantaged communities. Specifically in the water sector, almost every grant program in the last 10 years has, or at least 5 years, has included this carve-out. And this is also an issue that was raised by appellants in the Water Fix covered action appeal. The Delta Plan does include a section dedicated to the human right to water, and a suite of water quality actions that are responsive to disadvantaged communities. But again, there may be additional policy responses that are required here or additional narrative content that needs to be added. So what we're recommending is to develop an issue paper summarizing best available science and identifying policy options related to environmental justice and to really tease out what that would mean for the Delta Plan. And council staff is already developing a public participation plan, which we think will be responsive partially to this issue in terms of at least getting disadvantaged communities into the decision-making process and communicating with them more effectively. The next issue is Delta.
Go ahead, Ken.
Yeah.
No, thank you. Sorry. I just got back from vacation, so I think I'm, like, more energetic or something. But this issue came up a lot in the CSO amendment process. And we had and I want to just, you know, suggest that the issue paper, especially since we're dealing with statewide policy goals, water supply reliability, especially because some of the advocates during CSO were trying to kind of set this up as, gee, water supply south of the Delta, especially in the Central Valley, Kern County, that is, it's all about kind of, you know, developer-driven. But there's disadvantaged communities, large disadvantaged communities in the service area, the water service area, the Delta, in the farming communities. And water supply reliability, you know, in the absence of that, and, you know, the sustainable groundwater, you know, that if we don't have water supply reliability, that's going to have an impact on those disadvantaged communities. It's going to have a severe economic impact. And our scope is much broader than just within the Delta when it comes to water supply reliability. So I would hope that, you know, if we're looking at environmental justice and disadvantaged impacts on disadvantaged communities or getting them involved, you know, we need to think about those communities in the Central Valley that, you know, rely on agricultural employment, the multiplier effect on local businesses and those economies, because clearly if you don't have the water and you fallow the land and you take out hundreds of thousands of acres out of production because water supply is unreliable, that's going to have a big impact, and the hardest impact is going to be on those disadvantaged communities. And you know, since we're a statewide body, we have to think about that.
That's a good point. Thank you. The next issue is the Delta as an evolving place. We really highlighted three key emerging issues related to this: the connection between existing agricultural practices, economic sustainability, development pressures, and increasing risk; cultural resources, tribal values, and ecocultural values; and improved use of emerging social science research. And on each of these areas, we've already begun to do some of the work here. So I think the climate change vulnerability assessment is one aspect of risk to the Delta. Certainly there are others, including development pressures and subsidence and other issues that may need to be addressed in greater detail. With respect to cultural issues, the recent designation of the Delta as a national heritage area certainly helps to deal with some of that and bring some of those issues to the fore. So we're really interested to see how that plays out in the future and contribute to those efforts. And then the use of emerging social science information, and the council has recently impaneled a social science task force, and they will be reporting back on how agencies can incorporate social science in their policy making and decision making. So I think all of these things are moving forward, and our recommendation here is to prepare an issue paper summarizing the best available science and identifying policy options, you know, following completion of some of those ongoing studies and as we get the information from those studies to move forward.
Oscar.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Just the one comment I would make under the second bullet, the tribal values, I would highly encourage and maybe even underscore the notion of actually doing proactive communication with some of the tribes who have become much more active in the Delta and are certainly interested in being asked to have a seat at the table in these conversations, certainly under the evolving place in light of the National Heritage Area, certainly is one, but in other ways as well. So I know there's been expressed interest in that, so that might be something you want to underscore.
Thank you. And I will point out that we did interview a tribal group for the five-year review to get their input as well.
One question. Maria. On social science research, it's mostly demographics. What is included in the social science research?
it's much, much broader than demographics, economic issues, you know, all social science decision-making issues, engagement, all the, you know, the previous issue of thinking about disadvantaged communities, all those kinds
historical
of
historical development. Of-
yeah, so the social science task force is trying to, that Andrew mentioned, is a group of scientists from outside the Delta, a few from in the Delta, but more from outside the Delta who've worked on those kinds of issues in other systems that are going to be giving us advice on mm-hmm. how do we engage social scientists here so that we have much more information, because part of it, there's just not a lot of research, not a lot of work currently going on in those areas. You know,
and,
thinking about
historic preservation goes under that.
That would be part, yeah. All of those issues. So the Social Science Task Force will be meeting in July, a public meeting to talk about what kinds of research is going on in other systems and how we could think about incorporating that. They've already had one meeting in January where they got input from agency staff members about what the current issues they're working on mm-hmm. that are relevant to those kinds of issues, so they could think about the decisions and how that relates to the
And
relevant
and they
science.
Also have their stakeholder participation.
Yes,
to know what the issues are. I remember in a tour that the Delta that we took, there was a lot of issues coming up in just the simple people that we were meeting with, which I was not, you know, that keen on. And it was useful and helpful to learn all that in the light of things that we know, the agencies know, and it's on the radar, and things that are not, that comes out of the public outreach process.
Yeah, so we've had separate from the social science task force, we've had one meeting with to bring in stakeholder input on that issue, and we're trying to get that information out to them,
to the social science task force.
Both trying to communicate between the social science task force and the local stakeholders, so that each of that group is aware of what's happening.
Okay. Thank you.
That brings us to our last recommendation and finding. This is about federal coordination and participation. So we are recognizing the need for greater participation and involvement by federal agencies to help implementation of the plan. It's backed up by a 2018 Government Accountability Office report that found that the federal agencies and the Delta are not following federal guidelines established by the federal government to guide federal efforts in the Delta watershed. Further, although the Delta Reform Act does require federal agencies to does not require federal agencies to participate in certification of consistency process, federal agencies do participate in DPIC, and many of them have been active participants. And there's an established history of quite good state and federal collaboration on Delta issues, particularly with respect to science investigations and monitoring. And the recent PSN is a good example of that. The Delta Reform Act also did call for the Delta Plan to be developed consistent with the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act, or CZMA. With CZMA authority, the Council could potentially have greater authority over federal actions that affect the Delta. However, the Delta Plan has not, to this point, been submitted to the federal government for inclusion in CZMA or the California Program, Coastal Zone Management Program. So our recommendations on this topic are to continue to use DPIC to improve federal coordination and participation in Delta Plan implementation. And that's going to be through communicating with recommendations on what needs to be done, and to build those linkages for funding and for communication and science in that forum. And then to continue staff-to-staff coordination to build relationships and align voluntary alignment with federal agencies. So this is particularly important with the Army Corps of Engineers because of their role in flood protection in the Delta. And we have worked with them quite closely through the years at the staff level as well. And then finally, development of another issue paper that documents steps necessary to submit the Delta Plan to the Secretary of Commerce for inclusion into the Coastal Zone Management Program, and to explore not just CZMA, but trade-offs for going after CZMA or additional potential strategies for improving federal participation in the Delta Plan implementation. And with that, I will conclude and ask you, have we covered everything?
Mm-hmm. Well, before we address the have we covered everything, I have a question, Andrew, on the trade-offs.
Yeah.
Of pursuing CZMA, does that imply that if we pursue CZMA, we're limiting ourselves? Is that what you mean by trade-offs, or are we talking about resources spent on that pursuit?
I think the latter.
Okay.
It's a heavy lift.
Okay. Thank you. Ken.
I promise this is my last one, Andrew. The individual Delta Plan chapters, there's a lot of effort put into the recommendations. And, you know, that's sort of the non-regulatory piece of it. And I don't know our sense of how effective. I mean, I was just here for the CSO amendment, but we put a lot of effort and thought into those recommendations, yet they're just recommendations. So it would be helpful during the five-year review if we look at, gee, how effective are our recommendations and, you know, what's our strategy? If we're making the recommendations, we'd like to see them followed. We're not using the regulatory lever to make it happen, but what, you know, can we put more emphasis on getting those recommendations through, or should we recommend that, you know, we scale back on the recommendations, you know, when the next time we update the plan, if, you know, this is kind of a, you know, how are we going to implement? What's the role of the policies versus the recommendations? Are the recommendations important in implementation, but we'd rather rely on persuasion? And that seems to be a strategy that you have to come up with. Or it's not worth our time doing it unless, you know, we feel like we've got buy-in and the agencies are going to follow through on those recommendations.
Yeah, I think... Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head, is that's part of the discussion here, and I think part of the presentation was we really did a pretty thorough analysis of are the recommendations being implemented. And I think it's actually in 5 years a pretty amazing success story that as many are, considering that we've spent most of our time amending the Delta Plan and not following up with agencies on the recommendations. So I think it's very positive. Of course, we've recognized that there are some recommendations in the Delta Plan that just really aren't relevant anymore. Is that enough to cause us to, you know, advise you that we need to amend the plan immediately? I don't think so. They can be cleaned up the next time there's a substantive, you know, amendment. But I think what we want to discuss is, okay, then which recommendations are, you know, the key recommendations where we want to allocate staff time, council time, council agenda time over the next 5 years, which are still the most important, still the most relevant. We've identified categories here, and I think when we come back in August, we want to talk a little bit more about the next layer down and get a bit more specific and understand whether you agree that we've identified the right suite, especially based on the retreat discussion.
Okay, council members, have they, with all this hard work, covered everything that we think ought to be included? Yeah, Maria, yes. Great.
Susan, I would just like to compliment staff on the level of effort that they've put into it. I thought the summary of the interviews with the stakeholders and other agencies was extremely helpful, and it's rich with a lot of things to think about. I agree with your general assessment that we don't need to do major amendments. We've covered the ones that were required because of changes, and now shifting to an implementation a full implementation strategy seems to be the right place to go at this time. So I look forward to hearing some more specifics in August when you bring those back. But I support the track that you're on and appreciate the work that you've done to get us this far.
Thank you. I do want to point out one thing looking ahead to August is that in your supplemental binder that you got today and available on our website is the full updated list of Delta Plan policies and recommendations. So you might want to spend a little bit of time with that document in anticipation of the August discussion. If you have questions about specific recommendations and their status, or in the meantime, if you have further analysis that you want us to do on how a recommendation could be approached, we would appreciate that kind of feedback and input.
Sure. I just had a comment on that, and going back to the work that the staff did, I think in organizations like ours where you are more of a recommending entity versus a regulatory, and it's very different when you're a part of a regulatory entity, I think a lot of burden goes on to the staff just because there's so much more consensus building and reaching out to everybody versus if you were a regulatory body. And I think that's I just want to appreciate the work you did, because kind of it becomes transparent. I mean, people don't see it, but so much of it is on convincing everybody on everything versus just telling them, go do it. And that work is mostly carried by the staff in bodies like ours. Thank you.
Yes. Oscar.
Yeah, just one last thing I just wanted to add, and it's something that I've always searched or always struggled to find a place to place it. I don't know if this is the right one, but I think if you think about in terms of what 5 years means, it means that the eighth grader that's in school today learning and understanding and trying to figure out what one of their biggest fears are, which is environmental degradation, would be a graduating college student 5 years later. And that means they're in the pursuit of the workforce, and they're now looking for opportunities to advance their careers. And so I guess I use that five-year window as an opportunity to remind us as a policymaking body to consider elements of that in everything we do. And I don't find a perfect spot, but I think it's something we ought to be thinking about in terms of partnering with our sister agencies and educating and finding a way or a path to embed this conversation with children and with young adults who are going to be in the workforce 5 years from now, those that are eighth graders. And so I wanted to put that on the table as a reminder to all of us that what better way to educate the future workforce, not even the future really, as what the Delta Plan is, because I think that was one of the components that was addressed earlier in the presentation is the confusion and the understanding of what is the Delta Plan and does it exist and how does it apply to me. And while it may not apply to every kid today, it will very quickly when they try to get clean drinking water or try to recreate or, you know, fish. And so I struggle with where to put it, but I just want to put that on the table as a reminder to all of us.
Your words really resonate, and I think I mean, humbly, my offer that our agency is probably better at doing that than any of the other agencies that I'm aware of, with the funding that the council provides to the Delta Science Fellows, with our hosting of Capital Fellows on an annual basis. Yesterday, Ryan Stambra and I spent time with young grads from the University of San Francisco who might serve as McCarthy Fellows this summer in our office. We have legal externs at any given time of the year. And in my executive officer's report, I'll talk a little bit about State Scientist Day and some of the efforts that our staff recently engaged in, reaching even younger than that. So I think we do place a huge value here on the next generations of scientists and policymakers and familiarity with the Delta and its challenges. And so I appreciate you raising that. It's very important to me personally, and I think we've heard that in the past from board members as well.
Civic Spark, too.
Yep. Perfect.
Well, thank you for your excellent hard work and this great presentation. Very clear. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Any public comments? No. Next up is item 7B has been moved up due to scheduling conflicts. And Welcome, Ryan and Kate.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I had to see where we were at in the clock. Thank you for your indulgence in terms of moving the report up a little bit. As you'll see, I'm once again joined by Kate Melanson. With the release of May Revise and bills required to pass out of their house of origin by the end of this month, May is kind of the natural midway point for the first year of the legislative session. Additionally, with last week being the appropriations deadline, something I'm sure Councilmember Gatto, who's not here at the moment, but as a former chair of that committee in the Assembly, probably remembers fondly, there are a number of bills that are no longer active for the year. As it relates to those within the purview of council interests, two-year bills now include AB 835 Quirk, which would have required the state board to establish minimum standards to protect the public from harmful algal blooms. I think that's something that Kate presented last month. AB 441 Eggman, which would have included the diversion of water to underground storage as part of the beneficial use doctrine. Now, at the April council meeting, Councilmember Weinberg inquired about two measures that seek to augment water supply either directly or indirectly through the reuse of wastewater. AB 292 Quirk, which Kate will present shortly, and SB 332 by Senator Bob Hertzberg. As the council is aware, reducing reliance on the Delta, as we, I think, had a really substantive conversation this morning on the five-year review, and improving regional self-reliance is not only a prominent regulation in the Delta plan, but also a state policy in the Delta Reform Act. And with that, I'll turn it over to Kate to talk a little bit about AB 292.
Hello, council members. I'm California Sea Grant State Fellow Dr. Kate Melanson, and today I'm going to be talking to you about Assembly Bill 292, which was introduced by Assembly Member Quirk from Oakland about drinkable recycled water. Wastewater is often treated for non-drinking uses or before it is returned to a body of water. This bill primarily focuses on wastewater that will ultimately become drinking water. The purpose of this bill is to reduce confusion over the uses of recycled water by simplifying the definition of potable reuse. The recycled water policy drafted by the State Board contains goals that align with the policy recommendations from Chapter 3 of the Delta Plan on reduced reliance on the Delta. This bill itself would not directly reduce reliance, but instead would work toward improving acceptance of recycled water uses. However, before potable reuse is established, a review conducted by an expert panel on behalf of the State Board suggests further research on monitoring and necessary removal of pathogens from wastewater, identifying suitable final treatment processes for persistent chemicals, and developing methods to identify unknown contaminants. The findings of this research will allow for thorough evaluation of the performance and reliability of potable water treatments. As of now, there's no opposition to this bill, and it recently passed out of the Assembly and awaits its policy hearing in the Senate.
Correct. Thanks, Kate. Turning now to SB 332 by Bob Hertzberg, which would require wastewater treatment plants that discharge through ocean outfall to reduce their overall discharge volume by 50% by 2030 and 95% by 2040. According to the State Board, 65 wastewater treatment plants that would be subject to the bill currently discharge more than 1.3 million acre feet of treated wastewater annually into the ocean, bays, and estuaries, meaning as a result of SB 332, facilities would be required to divert at least 650,000 acre feet each year to other beneficial uses or reduce inflow through conservation or efficiency. For context, urban water use in California currently accounts for approximately 7.8 million acre feet annually. The bill is sponsored by the NRDC and the California Coastkeeper Alliance and supported by a number of environmental and social justice organizations and opposed by groups such as AQUA, the California Association of Sanitation Agencies, and the League of California Cities. In terms of status, SB 332 was actually held on suspense in the Senate Appropriations Committee last week and is now a two-year bill. And then finally, this morning, I'd like to talk a little bit about SB 1. This is the bill by Senate President Pro Tem Tony Atkins, which would establish minimum federal environmental, public health, and labor standards as state baselines in the event Congress or the President repeals or weakens corresponding federal standards. As it relates to the Council, the state baselines that this bill seeks to preserve include the Clean Water Act, Safe Drinking Water Act, and the Endangered Species Act. As a general rule, California is free to adopt its own standards in these areas so long as they do not fall below the standards set by the federal government. In cases where the California standard is pegged to or influenced by the federal standard, however, when federal protections slip, so do those in California. The bill passed, which passed out of the Senate last week, is supported by labor and environmental interest and opposed by a mix of business groups and industry associations and some water districts who contend that the bill introduces uncertainty over applicable standards and exposes them to unwarranted litigation. Turning to the budget, where last week the Senate rejected the administration's budget proposal that would have established a 95-cent tax on most residential water bills aimed at improving drinking water systems, and in turn offered a continuous appropriation of $150 million as an alternative to addressing this matter. It's important to note, however, that the Assembly has not taken action on the governor's proposal at this point, so this issue may ultimately be resolved in the Budget Conference Committee. As a reminder, the legislature is required to send a budget to the governor by June 15th in order to receive their pay for that month. And then finally, earlier this month, Governor Newsom introduced an executive order with the goal of statewide water resilience for the 21st century. The order lays out a two-pronged approach focused first on assessing the current state of things like statewide supply and demand needs, anticipated climate impacts, and existing policies, programs, and investments, and the effectiveness of those. Once the assessment is complete, the second phase will focus on the development of a portfolio guided by a number of principles, including an emphasis on multi-benefit approaches, incorporation of natural infrastructure, and strengthening partnerships across all levels of government and the NGO community. Building upon the approach of the Branham administration and its development of the California Water Action Plan, this executive order holds tremendous potential to build upon the progress that has been made in recent years. Going forward, council staff will explore opportunities to assist the administration with implementation of the order and certainly keep the council apprised of substantive developments going forward. And with that, that concludes my report. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
One quick question. On the Hertzberg bill, the opponents you said were Association of Sanitation. Is that like a organized?
It's a trade association that represents kind of the sanitation agencies throughout the state of California.
Mm, okay. So because we're dealing in the South, we're dealing with this issue because the Mayor Garcetti said zero to discharge instead of 50%. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to know who the opponents are. I know there's a lot, but okay, great, thank you.
Yeah.
Ken.
I just wanted to explain why I asked them to come back with this. And good report, Kate and Ryan, and kind of gets to Maria's comment, you know, that this is the single biggest reduced reliance strategy that is going on in the state. And these bills, I mean, there's controversy around the Hertzberg bill because you can't, it's very difficult to operate, to reuse 100%. It's really difficult, you know, there are cost implications and operational implications. So,
and storage.
Yeah, you know, I was surprised. I thought it had more momentum, but people, you know, but the goal is good. The Quirk bill, I think it's important because, you know, regulations are what really drives these local water supplies. And right now, it's more complicated to comply with the regulations for potable reuse in a groundwater basin or a surface reservoir. What they want to do here is, because the technology is advanced, the science is advanced, it's maybe you don't need as much complicated buffer, environmental buffers is what they have to use. So this is really the next step in potable reuse. And when you look at reduced reliance, the biggest gains are going to be in water conservation and water reuse. And the only way to really maximize water reuse is through these potable reuse projects. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, Mayor Garcetti's emphasis on reusing all of Hyperion, the projects going on in my county in San Diego, that's really indicative. Santa Clara County is looking at a potable reuse project. So if we're going to see big gains in reduced reliance, it's going to be through these types of projects and things that, you know, we should support. It's important, and or at least encourage this, but recognize that this is going on, and, you know, you've got legislative support for these things, that it is, it's important to what we do. If they get clear regulations out by 2023, there are projects like, you know, LA's Hyperion plant that will go forward. Full disclosure, I work on a couple of those projects, but, you know, it's just important to us. This is important to us, or we will not achieve water supply reliability. And I would think that Governor Newsom and Wade Crowfoot's efforts on this resilience plan will probably feature things like this pretty significantly.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Any public comment? Nope. Well, thank you to our dynamic duo. Next up, we have item four, our Water Master Quarterly update from Michael George. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to give you an update on what's going on in the Office of the Delta Water Master, but I'd like to start by saying the session you just had on the update of the plan is terrific. It's wonderful to sit here and listen not only to the staff's proposal, but for the kinds of discussion that's going on. I think that plan is becoming more important to agencies outside of the Stewardship Council. That's certainly the case within the State Water Sources Control Board. And I also want to give a shout-out to your staff. The quality of the preparation and support we get from the staff for our efforts on implementation or input on the Delta Plan, in my view, is terrific compared to any other state agency that I deal with on a regular basis. Okay.
Thank you.
So a bit of an overview. We've got a couple of announcements to make, and then some good news about progress that we're pursuing. And don't want to end on a bad note, but there is some bad news, particularly about what's going on or not going on within the southern part of the Delta. So I'll try and move through these relatively quickly, but encourage you to stop me anytime that you'd like to ask a question or have better clarification for some of the things that we're talking about and doing within the Office of the State, Office of the Delta Water Master within the State Water Board. So first of all, we've got two recent appointments. Most of you have already had the opportunity to meet and interact with our new chair, Joaquin Esquivel, and our new board member, Laurel Firestone. Obviously, Joaquin has been on the board for 2 years and just assumed the chairmanship. Laurel is new, but deeply conversant with a lot of the issues that the Water Board is dealing with. And like anybody new to our board, drink it out of a fire hose to catch up with the other things. Secondly, a brief update on the Water Quality Control Plan. And as Andrew mentioned, this is one of the areas where it's taken longer to get to perfect policy than some people scheduled at the beginning. I had mentioned in my last report that the Water Board had just adopted the first phase of the water quality control plan, that is on the San Joaquin River and its tributaries, and open the door for more development of voluntary agreements to mesh with that. Well, the first clarification of those voluntary agreements came in as scheduled on March 1st. They're more refined than the initial set that was presented at the Water Board's December meeting where they adopted the plan. And now I would say that there's a very robust process in which the California Department of EPA, Resources Agency, as well as Food and Ag and the Water Board, really trying to coordinate a cohesive state policy to see if it is possible to take those voluntary agreements and weave them in to the Water Quality Control Plan program of implementation, because everybody recognizes that the big advantage, if we are able to do that, is that we'll get real improvements starting sooner, because there is at least the hope and the promise that we'll short-circuit and avoid a certain amount of litigation that is inevitable with the adoption of anything as comprehensive as the Water Quality Control Plan. So that is an ongoing process. It's taking a lot of effort of all those agencies right now. It's kind of sucking a lot of the a lot of air out of the room as to other things. But that's the update on really what's going on with the state board. I'll hesitate for a moment in case there are any questions on any of that.
Any questions on the voluntary agreement process?
Nope. Okay. So I'd like to report progress on several fronts, things we've been working on for some time. Improving water rights data in the Delta, an ongoing problem, effort. Enhancing the annual water use reporting to use it in more ways and to get it to be more comprehensive and accurate. Challenges that we're facing with respect to implementation of the regulations requiring measurement of every diversion in the Delta. And good news here is the development of a potentially superior alternative that we're going to try and suggest as an alternative in the Delta. And then I want to just touch as well on some of the things we're doing to coordinate with the council's initiatives. So I've reported before that we're working to get a better handle on the senior water rights in the Delta. Recognize that's much more of the water demand in the Delta is senior, and in the sense they're riparian or pre-14 water rights, so they originate and are exercised prior to and outside the administrative jurisdiction of the state board. We had very little information on them and conflicting and confounding data when it came to serious shortage in 2014 and 15 of not being able to fully understand what the demands were. So we've worked on that with the Division of Water Rights and the state board to mine lots of different data sources. Most importantly, I would say the 2015 information order, where for the first time, those who claimed these senior water rights were asked to come forward with the documentation to support them. And that's how we built the taxonomy. We put it out there, and we have an ongoing process of crowd correction with people who are claimants to those water rights, and it is dramatically improving our understanding of those water rights, opening up kind of that black box that was the totality of these water demands in the Delta, so that we can understand the better, so that we can correct common misconceptions. And one of the best examples of that is the misconception about overlap between pre-14 and riparian rights. We published a memorandum that states our view of what the law is, and we're trying to help people as they report their water use to implement those distinctions and to get better response. It gives us also the opportunity to cross-reference data, so we've got that taxonomy that came out of the 2015 information order as it's being corrected, and now we're getting these annual reports with better data. And the value of this is not just for the state board or even for the stewardship council. It's really for the water user community to know what's out there, what the demands are. And we're already seeing that as we're making that information available, we're finding water users in the Delta starting to try and shore up their water rights potentially by entering into water supply contracts and other mechanisms that indicate that they are taking this data and using it to better implement their drought response plans. When we've got lots of water in the system, as we've got now, we've got the luxury of some time and some benefits from that flow. So we're really trying conscientiously to take advantage of that as we've got the flow. So one of the things I'd like to highlight is this compliance with the annual reporting requirements. There's this kind of a busy chart, but what it basically shows is consistent development for the last 3 years in terms of how many people file their reports on time, and then reducing the period of time it takes us to get to 100% compliance. But I'm pleased to say that as of today, actually as of May 20th, we had 100% compliance in annual reporting by licensees in the Delta. Now, again, you can see from the number there, there are only 327 licenses in the Delta compared to 2,653 senior water rights. But getting 100% compliance is pretty remarkable in a pretty short period of time. And I would say that getting that is largely a result of the partnerships that we've developed with the water agencies in the Delta. They are actually the go-between. So the licenses were due April 1st. That was actually celebrated as Cesar Chavez Day. So the real deadline was April 2nd. And on April 3rd, we sent out a spreadsheet to these agencies and to other members of the Delta Water Bar and consulting agencies, and we gave them a list of all those who were delinquent, that is, who had missed the deadline of April 1st. And these agencies went to work, cleared those delinquencies, and as I say, we got the last of them filed May 13th. So that has allowed us to move from just getting the reports in to doing QA/QC on those reports, to improving the quality of the data that's in there and cross-referencing it so that we've got multiple data points to support our overall view of what's going on with water use in the Delta. So one of the things we do is make it well known through those agencies that late submissions get increased scrutiny. Now, there are two reasons for that. One is it's a little added incentive to get in on time. But secondly, we've discovered over time that those which are late tend to have the most errors. And it makes sense. You're late because you don't have the right information or you don't understand it well enough. So we really work with the late submitters to help them get on track, not only to correct errors when we find them, to help give them assistance and put them on a track for next year. This also allows us to spot consistent sources of error and to mitigate that by publishing our guidance, putting it out on our LIRIS list, putting it on our website, as well as dealing with individual errors. We get a lot of requests for assistance this time of year. People are moving, are leading up to the July 1 deadline for filing the statements of diversion use, so we get a lot of requests for assistance. We're conducting lots and lots of field visits now to help people parse out in the field how they ought to manage their reporting. We're working very closely with those intermediate agencies. And we're also getting feedback. I always think that when you go out to help somebody, you're also it's a learning opportunity. You got to understand more when you walk away than you did when you walked in. So it's really a two-way street. And one of the things that comes out of that is feedback to improve the quality of our forms so they're not so confusing, so that we don't get double counting or misreporting because of errors or difficulties in our forms. So I'm going to move to diversion measurement. This is one of the big implementation things that we're trying to do. Do you have a question, Oscar? Oh, okay. All right. I didn't want to move too quickly. So in terms of this initiative to implement the legislative requirement to measure every diversion in the Delta, we've run into some problems that I've discussed with you before, basically, particularly with respect to siphons. It turns out that siphons are inherently hard to measure. There are lots of them throughout the Delta. They come in different sizes, different ages, different conditions, different frequency of use. And one of the things that we find is that the various different attempts to measure, we haven't found them that work consistently. There are a lot of breakdowns. Service and maintenance is a real problem in the Delta. And just knowing that it's broken down can sometimes be a problem because these are in remote areas that aren't visited every day, aren't visible, particularly in some of the smaller ones. And if you can appreciate that if you're a ditch tender and you got to get water to a crop and you come out and the meter isn't working, that doesn't stop you from opening up the diversion and putting water on the crops, nor should it. So the other thing about this is when you get the information of inconsistent reliability, it's not reported for most diversions in the Delta until the following year, until July of the following year. So you get data of questionable accuracy in the middle of the following irrigation system. It's not very useful in terms of making decisions about what you should plant or where you should fallow or how you should prioritize your water use, particularly in times of shortage. It just comes too late, and it's not consistent, and it's not actionable data. So we put together this consortium called the Delta Measurement Experimentation Consortium, consisting of these folks, some engineers, some NGOs, some water users, and we've tried to grapple with these through an experimentation process. We figure there are an infinite number of mistakes to be made. We don't need to make the same ones over and over again. So we try and share what we learn and what we're getting. And through this process, we've not only solved some of the problems, particularly I think we've done a pretty good job of solving the problem of measuring pumped diversions. That's a little bit easier. It's more like what's going on in upland farming and other parts of the watershed. As I say, we haven't quite got it on siphons yet, which are the predominant diversions in the central part of the Delta. Ken, you're nodding because you saw a bunch of them about this time last year. So what we are doing is proposing an alternative to essentially substitute remote sensing of crop water use for measuring every single diversion within the Delta. We'll still measure a number of them so that we can have that information for ground truthing and for calibration, but we're going to try and move, I'm proposing, that we should move to remote sensing and that we should start with that alternative in the Delta. Why? Number one, in the Delta, there is no diversion to storage, so you haven't got the distortion that you get from diverting water at one time for using it at another time. When you divert water in the Delta, you're putting it to beneficial use roughly immediately. Secondly, if you over-divert, if you take more water out of the channel than your crop needs, you're going to have to return it to those channels. Every one of these islands has a return drainage requirement, and that has some expense, which is a discipline on diverting too much water. But in any case, water that is over-diverted and not used for the crops returns to the Delta in close proximity in time and location to where it was taken out. So the distortion that over-diversion creates is much less in the Delta than elsewhere. In addition, we think it makes sense to focus on that part of the water system where you can manage the data you're developing, and that's water use. That's the water that comes out of the system through evapotranspiration, use by the crops. So the the good news about remote sensing is that we can narrow down to a better understanding of what the actual crop water use is, even in the Delta. And that goes back to the scientific exercise that we went through that I've reported on before, which we're now moving through this open ET process, taking it out of the academic peer-reviewed journals and moving it to actual use for water managers, water regulators, and others to know closer to real time what's happening at the field level. We can get down to 30 meters by 30 meters, basically a crop field, and know what's the crop water use recently, and even within a very short period of time, we're going to be able to predict it out a week or two ahead to as we correlate weather with crop water use, and it's real-time information. It's consistent across the whole Delta because you're not relying on ditch tenders to keep the meters up or report when they go down. You're getting to see the whole Delta every time there's a pass, and whereas even just 2 years ago we had a pass every 16 days, we're now down to the place where we've got a pass about every 3 days, so we don't have to do as much interpolation.
Who enforces or who do you collaborate with in, as far as, is it a consortium doing this or is it the board? How does it get in, how do you regulate?
So good question. OpenET is a process that is a cooperative a process that involves several NGOs led by the Environmental Defense Fund, but including the Nature Conservancy and others, members of our consortium, several academic institutions, a number of industrial users, as well as the regulatory community. And so there's this process that's going on. It's a five-year process. We're about 2.5 years through it to, as I say, take the science of remote sensing and put it on your smartphone. So there will be an independent entity with input from government, input from regulators, input from water users, input from the NGO community, but will be independent. And what I am proposing is that the data that is available on your smartphone be a rebuttable presumption of actual water use. I jokingly refer to it as good enough for government work. The notion being that here's how much water we think is being used by that crop in that field today. And if you can give us better information so that we can do more machine learning, we'll improve it over time. But it's good enough for making real-time decisions and allowing regulators, water users, and other water managers. For instance, in the Delta, the export projects would love to have better information about close to instantaneous water use, because the alternative to that is what they do in most times, like now, where there's lots of water in the system. You can afford to put more water in there without disturbing anybody's use or the export opportunity. But when things get tight, to really understand what's being used in close to real time, much more valuable for export managers and farmers and others in the Delta. So that's what this OpenET process is. It does focus on water use, gives us close to real-time, consistent information, and allows us to learn and refine the process better and better over time. But as I pointed out when I described this to the Water Board at the board meeting on Tuesday, we recognize that this will require amendments to the legislation that would then fire up amendments to the regulations that implement that regulation, implement that legislation. So we've got some steps to go through. This is still a recommendation. It's got to be supported by data from that experimentation consortium. The rationale has to be developed, and we have to go through a process of explaining first within the administration, within the various departments who will care about this, and then ultimately to the legislature to make the changes to allow this to be done in the Delta. We think the Delta is the right place to roll it out first, but this has tremendous application when we talk about implementing Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. It is remote sensing that will allow us, we believe, to close the water balance calculations for groundwater agencies throughout the state. So we're proposing to do this, roll it out first in the Delta because of the unique opportunity, but to use this as a learning opportunity for SGMA implementation as well.
Now, really fascinating, Michael. So, you know, maybe putting it in kind of our Delta plan terms, sort of this is a piece of adaptively managing exports. So is there kind of a larger safety margin that the exporters use now absent this data what in Delta use is when they're deciding what to export? And so the idea here is that a certain, you know, they're conservative in their operating or rule curves, and they'll be able to be less conservative, and that'll add X CFS to the exports while also maintaining efficient water use. Is there a piece of this where you're trying to ascertain is water being used efficiently for these crops? Is that the other side of it?
So we'll get some of those benefits. You're quite right that in times like this, the export interests don't need to operate as close to the edge. There's lots of water in the system, and that's true for water use throughout California. When there's lots of water in the system, there's low conflict and so forth. The conflict all comes out. It's like Warren Buffett says, when the tide goes out, you see who's not wearing a bathing suit. It's when there's a shortage in the system, if you now understand better what the actual demands in the system are, and you can manage to take some pressure off of that. Remember back in 2015, we had voluntary efforts by a large group of farmers in the Central and South Delta who said, we understand the system is in crisis. We're concerned about the crop we're putting in at the beginning of the season having enough water to make it to the end. And they came forward with a voluntary program, which we implemented, where they cut back their diversions by 25% in order to have regulatory certainty that they wouldn't get cut back further later in the year. Well, we didn't know how that would work back then. One of the things that we're going to have from this data is better information so that farmers who want to help, who want to figure out how to be more efficient, or just want to say, I got trees that I got to water, I'll forego alfalfa and, you know, cut it one time, one fewer cuttings this year. This information should give them better tools to make those kinds of responses work in real time. Okay. So I told you I wanted to focus on two areas where our office is in close collaboration and coordination with council initiatives. Andrew touched on both of them in his report. This Delta Science Funding and Governance Implementation Initiative, which was adopted or supported by the DPIC on April 8th. That work group has now formed under Randy's chairmanship and Lash. We've got four subgroups that are now working on that implementation strategy. I'm the chair of one of those. This is an area where, because of this council's initiative, this is someplace where our chair, Joaquin Esquivel, has rallied more resources from the state board to support this effort. So it'll be me, but with a larger cadre of people from the Bay Delta unit of the Division of Water Rights who are supporting this, because we think this is a really critical thing for us. Because if we can get this right, if we can get improved funding and governance on a consistent basis over time, we believe that it'll help the state board to proceed with regulatory and other aspects of its responsibilities with less controversy over what the science is. So we're all in on this. Secondly, the climate change vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy, again, Chairman Esquivel has put more resources into that because we've recognized that if we help, we put our insight, our views, and so forth into this process, it'll be a gift that comes back to us in terms of allowing us as we move forward in terms of making decisions about how we manage water quality, water supply, availability, and so forth. If we can rely on that vulnerability assessment and adaptation strategy and say, for instance, this is the basis on which we're taking this regulatory action. So, again, we're all in. We're putting more resources into this because of the initiative that you've created and the really fine staff work that is going in to each of these efforts. And overall, this is part of our buying into your strategy of herding all the scientific cats into the One Delta, One Science so that we get better peer review at the time the science is developed. And by that, I mean people who are conversant with what other people are doing in the science cosmos under the science action plan, so that you get that friction between informed science at the earlier stage, which should result, as it has already, in better science. And I would say that John was over at the State Water Board on Tuesday giving his report to the board, and I think that's a really important area where we're getting better traction between the Water Board and the Stewardship Council, particularly in the science action agenda. So that's all good news, or at least progress being made. But I really do want to spend some time today talking about what I think is the really bad news, that is not just that the South Delta is facing serious deterioration, as it has been for some time, but that deterioration is accelerating. And in turn, that deterioration makes attaining the co-equal goals more difficult. It reduces the ecosystem services that we should expect from that large portion of the delta. It certainly impedes fish migration in ways that I'll talk about in a minute. One thing that doesn't often occur to us regulators is that it also constricts the availability of capital to make improvements in the delta. If the delta itself is unsustainable and its future is uncertain, it's very hard to go to your banker and suggest long-term investments. And that, you know, that's a vicious circle, because if you can't make investments, if you can't keep up your equipment, and you see it, I see it most visibly in the deterioration of the marinas around the delta. It's hard to keep your docks up and your pump out facilities and all that kind of stuff when you're losing recreational navigation around the delta because of some of these other problems. And in addition to that, it really magnifies the kind of conflicts that we run into in terms of different objectives for water use. So we're losing aquatic industrial habitat without any real reconciliation strategy. No real budget, no plan, no vision. And I want to contrast that with these two maps. On the left, you've seen these maps before. This is Echo Restore. And you see the restoration and reconciliation efforts that go through that northwest portion of the delta. On the right, you see the Delta Corridor development, where we're trying to string together publicly owned lands and try and do restoration there. But what each of these maps has in common is white space in the South Delta. There is no current coordinated effort to restore the Southern Delta ecosystem. And so what we're finding is a big problem with sediment buildup. It's really choking the channels in the Southern Delta. I'll talk more about why that's happening, but the results of that are we've got increases in water temperature, in the number and severity of toxic algae blooms, and in the concentration of elements that make the water less lower quality. The net flow in some of these channels is seriously constricted, which means that you can't suck water through those channels to export it or to bring it to your farm. And it also means that you've got lower dissolved oxygen, which is bad for fish. It makes it much easier for invasive species to get established and to put roots down. I mean, that's one of the things where you've got hyacinth that floats. But if you deal with that, you've got primrose that has it loves to put its roots into that sediment that that builds up. It substantially impacts navigation. So, number of boat visits to those marinas. I'm out in the Delta quite a bit, and you think you're going to go someplace in a boat to check something out, and you find that you can't get through that channel because it's so choked with weeds. And that, in turn, makes it very difficult to deal with flood response and levee maintenance, and it creates salinity hot spots and buildup, which are a regulatory as well as a management problem. So there's a picture here on the right of what we're talking about. This is Old River in the South Delta. This is a three wood from the overcrossing of the South Tracy Boulevard. And this is after the heavy rains we had in 2017. What happens is you get a lot of flow, which used to kind of flush out the delta. What you've got now is this increasing occlusion of the channels. So you get the fast-moving water, which we've got again this year. We're moving, 12,000 CFS at Vernalis on the main stem of the San Joaquin River. But as it moves out into the southern delta, that water slows down and drops the sediment. So a group of interested affected parties have come together in kind of an ad hoc process. We didn't put this together. We're a participant along with our Division of Water Rights, along with Department of Water Resources, the Bureau of Reclamation, San Luis Delta Mendota Water Authority, the South Delta Water Agency, among others. And what that group is doing right now is developing a problems statement and beginning to shine a light on what possible solutions. But once we get that problem statement done, we'll come back, for instance, to the Stewardship Council, to the Water Board, to others, to say, okay, here's the problem. Who wants to volunteer to be part of a process to study the problem, study possible solutions, and so forth? We already know that there are a number of obstacles to solving this problem. Permitting is a big one. The expense of both permitting and the time associated with permitting, but also the expense of actually removing the sediment and reusing it, and then the trade-offs between the impacts for managing this sediment and the positive impacts you get by dealing with it. And I keep saying I'm out in the Delta a lot, at least once a week, and it is frightening to me to see how badly this deterioration is accelerating in the South Delta and how much it impacts our ability to do so many of the other things that we want to do in terms of restoring the Delta. In addition, salinity hotspots are a problem associated with the sediment buildup, the invasive species, et cetera, because with less throughput in these South Delta channels, you get the buildup of salinity because the water's just sloshing back and forth on the reduced tidal energy, and particularly in the summertime when you get reduced inflow, this becomes really serious. It generates lots of conflict between water users, but it also generates a lot of conflict between the water users generally and the regulators. And in December, when the State Board adopted the first phase of the Water Quality Control Plan, among the things that they did was relax a little bit the salinity standard to attain water quality objectives in the Southern Delta. We did that in December. in January we had exceedances of the new relaxed standard. So we've clearly got to understand this problem better and deal with it in a more holistic way. And so this is an ad hoc group that our office actually convened, brought together operators in the Delta to try and look at this salinity issue. And we realized, first of all, that everybody has their famous or their favorite salinity report. It's the one that supports their point of view on what the problem is and whose fault it is and where the money should come from. But they are not really conversant with some of the other studies. So the idea here was to take that body of studies and reports that's been done and do the synthesis to help the current generation of water users, water managers, water regulators understand how this problem has developed, what we know about it, and to develop an objective synthesis. So Dr. Calloway, as lead scientist, will convene a panel to conduct this objective synthesis. But this is one where I think the oversight of that panel is going to be one of the critical aspects, not just to come out with an objective synthesis that everybody understands how they got there and what it means so that we've got a standard platform from which to proceed. But I really think this oversight process and the interaction between the panel and the oversight committee is going to be kind of group therapy, because it's going to force us all to sit around the table and hear from others what their perspective is on this in real time, in a way that they're trying to explain it to this objective scientific panel. And they're going to be listening, hopefully, to each other and not just going back to their corners and pointing fingers, but hopefully out of this comes a much more collaborative, holistic process for dealing with the overall problem. With respect to these, I haven't even mentioned predation yet. Predation has been a problem in the Southern Delta. So you get these little salmon smolts that try and make it through the gauntlet of the Delta with all these other things, and we can't forget also predation. And so we find that the Southern Delta is the killing fields for these out-migrating salmon. In addition, one of the big things that's going on in the Delta is this continued migration from annual crops to permanent crops, from corn and alfalfa and tomatoes that are annual crops that therefore can be managed for the inconsistency of our water supply, and moving toward nuts and grapes. That not only hardens the demand, even in times when it may reduce the demand. Certainly you reduce the demand in the picture that you see here, because it'll be a few years before these almond trees come to maturity. We should be capturing that insight we can know when that field gets planted what its 30-year water demand is going to be. We need to start incorporating that, and we need to recognize that the terrestrial habitat associated with what you see in the picture as compared to what might have been there a year or 2 years ago, which would be alfalfa or corn or sorghum or some other crop that's better habitat for the gophers and bunnies and owls and so forth. So this is what's going on. You can understand why farmers are making this move. They're moving to mechanization. They're avoiding the problems associated with the high cost and difficulty of finding labor. And they're going to higher value crops with longer shelf life and international markets. It's perfectly rational, but it is compounding the problems that I've talked about in the Southern Delta. And so one of the things I'd like to do here is offer to those of you who haven't been on it the second annual tour of the Delta, and I encourage you to talk to your fellow board members who are on the first version. I think you'll find it a useful thing. I'm suggesting Wednesday, June 26th, simply because that's the day before your next meeting, and it might be useful to some or all of you to join us on a tour that will involve both driving some of the levee roads and going on a boat and seeing some of these areas and getting a firsthand sense for it, talking to some of the people in the Delta, seeing from their perspective what the problems are, and recognizing as you go through that tour on a full day, starting in Sacramento and ending in Sacramento, how many different points of view there are and how narrow some of those points of view are. If you are growing crops on Coney Island, you may not know really what's going on Victoria Island, even though it's right across the water. And getting a sense for that helps give you a sense for why it's so hard to have the Delta treated as a monolith, why it's so difficult to get a consistent institutional representative of the Delta's point of view. You get a sense that the Delta is many points of view because it's many parts of an integrated system that's frankly not working so well these days. So that's what I've got to say. I appreciate your attention. I'm happy to take questions and glad to have the chance to bring you up to date on what's keeping me up at night.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions, council members? Yeah.
Yeah, Maria and Frank and Ken all went on it last year. We've got a hard limit of three so as to avoid having to conduct a public meeting on the waterways. And also, two of our newer board members, two of the Water Board's board members would like to come. So again, two there is short of a quorum, and I think it's also a good opportunity for, you know, kind of informal interaction between members of this council and that board. So if this is something that you'd like to do, I'd go to work to handle the logistics and carry it off, and if that June 26th is the right day to do it.
Michael, I do. Oh, go ahead, Mindy.
Michael, do you have any sense as to how much of this conversion from field crops to permanent crops is being done by new landowners in the Delta, particularly in Roberts Island in that region?
I don't have any statistics on that, Randy. I would say it's a lot. I think there are only two ways that you get into farming today. One is to inherit your land and a love for it and a passion for it. And the second is to attract institutional money. And there is institutional money coming in. They see the opportunity for a stable, long-term, inflation and risk-adjusted entry into the business. You know, I came from that business. I spent a lot of my career as an investment banker, and I spent several years managing an agricultural land trust in the San Joaquin Valley. And so I've both been part of that community and an observer of it. And on balance, I think it's bad for agriculture, primarily because of the way institutional money is organized. It's not long-term money. It's money with a life. And that life, 10 years typically, doesn't coincide very well with the cycles in the farming commodity business. So what you have is a lot of institutional money piling in at certain times and that money wanting to get out on a schedule that has nothing to do with the cycles in the agricultural industry. But to put in a an orchard like you see there, it's very capital intensive. It's 5 years before you get your first return if everything works out well. And there are lots of risks twixt here and there. Institutional money can take those risks, but when they need liquidity, they all head for the door irrespective of where we are in the ag cycle. So it's a reality of what's going on in the marketplace. I think it'll be disciplined somewhat by the implementation of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. But in the Delta, nobody uses groundwater. There's plenty of surface water available, and we're not going to have that same discipline directly in the Delta. Where we'll get it is in reducing reliance on the Delta. That'll have its impact on the Delta, but it'll be a secondary impact.
I would suggest that Sigma is driving the investments and new money. It would. I hope to join you on the tour, whatever date it is. It would be interesting to have available one of these new landowners or representatives of new landowners and hear their thoughts about the future of farming in the Delta.
I've got just the person in mind because I know somebody who's a longtime family in the southern San Joaquin Delta who has just come to work, become a partner in a larger institutional money operation and is aggressively moving into the Delta. And I don't mean aggressively, I don't use that in a pejorative sense. I mean going all in because they observe that there's water available. So I got somebody in mind to see if we can get on the tour.
Great. Judge.
Yeah, thank you. This is a pretty depressing story about the Southern Delta.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a focus of staff in terms of the problems that they have in the Southern Delta? It seems like it's intractable to a degree, but what is our efforts in that respect?
Well, I think as Mr. George highlighted, we're very involved right now in essentially providing some science services to the current effort, but obviously it's also part of the consideration in the larger ecosystem chapter amendment. But it is an intractable challenge, so I'm glad that there's a committee coming together so we could share resources and really get a better handle on what the policy solutions need to be.
Are you leading that committee, Michael?
So there are two ad hoc committees. One I'm participating in, that's the one on sedimentation. The other one on salinity is one that our office has organized, and I'm the chair of that oversight committee where I hope we're going to get the group therapy. I know I need some.
Well, thank you. Thank you for this thorough, excellent report.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Look forward to being with you in a quarter to have more of the same discussion.
Any questions from the public or comments? And any additional council comments, questions? Nope. Then we will break for lunch and return at 1:30. I'll wait for your cue, Zeke.
Thank you very much. Are we rolling on
the Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for returning. We're reconvening, and we'll start with agenda item 5, adoption of the April 25, 2019 meeting summary.
Move to accept.
Okay, we have a motion from Randy Fiorini and a second from Oscar Villegas. Any discussion? No public comment? Okay. We'll start with the vote. Ken on my right.
Weinberg, aye.
Dermo, aye.
Gatto, aye.
Maranian, aye.
Fiorini, aye.
Tatayan, aye.
Villegas, aye.
And motion passed. On to agenda item 6, Chair's report. It's been a busy month. We're taking to heart one of the comments made at our retreat about the chair and executive director getting out and reaching out to the public more often, being the face of the council. We, at Oscar's invitation, attended the Delta Protection Commission meeting this month, mostly as an opportunity to get to know them and also for them to get to know us. So I took the liberty of pulling a few statements from each of your biographies from our website and introduced the council to the Delta Protection Commission members. It was a really good meeting, and thank you, Oscar, for hosting us. A few of us also attended the Association of California Water Agencies conference in Monterey, and it was a very good conference. I want to compliment Bethany on her presentation. There was a panel on the legal framework governing the Bay Delta, and attorneys Jennifer Buckman, Meredith Nickel, Bethany Payne, and I'm blanking on the gentleman's name.
John Herrick.
John Herrick. It was a pretty feisty panel. but a lot of good information. No, mostly John, but it was a lot of good information. Yeah, John kept referring to himself as the grumpy South Delta something or other. There were excellent presentations by Chair of the Water Board, Joaquin Esquivel, and Secretary Blumenfeld and Secretary Crowfoot at that conference. And I attended the Independent Science Board meeting at the Gene Harvey Community Center, also another very good meeting. And that's it for the Chair's report. Any questions? No public comment. No. So on to executive officer's report.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Good afternoon. Just a few short announcements before we invite the executive officers of the Delta Conservancy and Delta Protection Commission to come up later and share some of their activities. Speaking of Supervisor Villegas' comment earlier about the importance of investing in youth and introducing Delta and water issues to future leaders, council staff took part in the state's annual State Scientist Day on May 8th at the Capitol. The annual event invites students to learn about what scientists do at the state level to protect public health, the environment, California's natural resources. The council hosted a booth in order for staff to interact with the public and educate young students about the value of the Delta and the science taking place there. So there were exhibits including viewing Delta organisms under a microscope, dissecting water hyacinth, and learning about where their water comes from and identifying nutria, of course, a fan favorite. So that's kind of one example of the ways we're trying to get at the mission that you outlined. Included in your binders is our April Outreach Highlights report. So I don't plan to go over it, but I always want to point out that it's there. And, of course, always let me know or Keith Coolidge, our comms person, know if you have any questions about that. We've got two letters in your packet this month on Delta Plan implementation and coordination. One is on a restoration project that's being done by Contra Costa County Public Works Department, and one on a levee improvement project along the Sacramento River being done by the Department of Water Resources. The Bethel Island Municipal Improvement District filed a certification of consistency with the Delta Plan for their Northwest Levee Improvement Project on April 18, 2019, and as of Monday, the appeal window did close. The purpose of this project is to provide higher flood protection on the northwest side of Bethel Island, and the project also plans to provide 4,500 linear feet of fish-friendly habitat. And there's more information about that project, including its certification, on our website. In personnel, Sam Beshevkin joins us as an environmental scientist in the Science Communication, Synthesis, and Decision Support Unit of our Delta Science program. He's finishing his PhD in marine ecology from UC Davis, and he has worked at the Bodega Marine Lab studying larval fish survival factors. Kaylee Griffith, who I had the pleasure of meeting yesterday, joins the planning unit as an environmental scientist, where she will work to implement and improve ecosystem restoration, among other issues. She received her BS in marine biology from UCLA and a master's in biology ecology from San Diego State, and has just moved up to Sacramento to join our team. So we want to welcome both of them. There's no legal update today, and we covered the legislative update earlier in our agenda. So now, as I invite up Eric Vink and Campbell Ingram to the table, we've invited them to share some of the Delta Stewardship Council Delta Plan relevant activities of their agencies. I wanted to echo Chair Tatayan's comments that I really appreciated Councilmember Villegas hosting us at the Delta Protection Commission meeting last evening. I think they were eager to hear about the ways in which the council staff is engaging with the Delta Protection Commission staff, and where we're supporting their work and vice versa. So just to quickly highlight for all of you, some of those areas that I talked about last Thursday night are National Heritage Area Planning and Implementation, Clarksburg Schoolhouse Restoration Planning, the development of community action plans in the Delta, and then currently council staff are also reviewing and advising on the Delta Protection Commission's Land Use and Resource Management Plan update and elements coming forth soon of their economic sustainability plan. So pretty much on any given week, we're meeting with members or of the staff of the Delta Protection Commission, so we appreciated that opportunity to share with their board our activities. So Campbell, I think, is going to provide a report on recent actions taken by his board to approve some grants, and that's relevant to us for a number of reasons. These are restoration projects and economic development projects, and some of them may eventually need to certify consistency with the Delta Plan. But there's some really good work going on there, so I look forward to the discussion.
Let me jump in. Am I looking for it's working. Okay, very good. Thank you, Jessica and Chair Tatayan. We really appreciate both of you joining us at the commission meeting last week. And council members, I'm Eric Vink with the Delta Protection Commission. And I just have a few things I want to say. I took great interest in the discussion this morning about the review of the five-year plan. And actually, a couple of things I wanted to report on are related to that. As the council was preparing the Delta Plan in 2012 and adopting it in 2013, the commission had completed an economic sustainability plan for the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta, mandated by statute, and the intention of that plan was to inform the Delta Plan in relation to how to protect and enhance the unique Delta values. Just as the council has a mandate to review its plan, we have a legislative mandate to review the economic sustainability plan. And although we're a little bit off in our timing, we are soon to have an update of the agricultural chapter of the economic sustainability plan. What we anticipate that including will be a refreshing of the statistics, and Michael George alluded to this earlier. There's more permanent plantings in the Delta. We know there's been a substantial percentage increase in additional grapes and almonds in particular. Council Member Fiorini's question earlier is one I'm real keenly interested in, and I don't know that we know the answer about who these landowners are that are investing in permanent crops, but I suspect that there's probably a fair involvement of either institutional investors or people from outside the region who are coming to the Delta. And that's a trend that we continue to see because there's plentiful water in the Delta. I know a specific example of a dairy operation in the southern San Joaquin Valley that two brothers have each purchased properties in different parts of the Delta. And I don't know a lot about their operation currently down there. I know they're dairy in the dairy business, but I'm sure that they've taken their forage ground down the valley and probably planted it into permanent plantings. And I know they're growing forage crops on their land in the Delta. So anecdotally, there's interesting evidence, but I'm interested in looking a little further into what those land ownership trends are as well. So updating the agricultural statistics, we're going to take a fresh look at what the current suite of proposed restoration projects means for agriculture in the Delta, what kind of an impact that will have on agriculture in the Delta. Just as the Delta plan was created under the specter of BDCP, we completed our economic sustainability plan in 2012 under the specter of Bay Delta Conservation Plan, and we're looking at a large proposed footprint for habitat restoration in the Delta. We have a reduced footprint now. We have very specific information on where those habitat projects take place, and so therefore we'll be able to do a pretty fine-tuned analysis of what that means to the ag economy in the Delta. And then finally, we're looking at the salinity impacts to agriculture in the Delta, which is primarily a central and mostly a South Delta issue, as the Delta Watermaster outlined for you all earlier today. So just as that work is wrapping up, we're initiating work on updating the recreation and tourism chapter of the Economic Sustainability Plan. And these two components, ag and recreation, are the pillar of the Delta economy. The intention of doing this is to not only provide information that can inform policy making, but also specifically to provide information that could inform further development and implementation of the Delta plan. And so just as with the original Economic Sustainability Plan forming the basis for a suite of recommendations that the council considered in 2012-2013, we would anticipate that we might have some recommendations to forward to the council. And so another reason why I'm real keenly interested in the five-year review and specifically the timeline for that as your council proceeds. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is that we are indeed updating our land use and resource management plan for the primary zone of the Delta. This is the mandated plan that restricts local government land use decisions within the primary zone. Our current land use plan has been in effect since 2011. A lot has changed since that time in Delta governance, and we hope to get a fresh look at what the current challenges are related to local government land use in the Delta and incorporating those into our land use plan update. So unless there are questions, that's really what I wanted to provide to you this afternoon. And I thank you for the opportunity to give you an update.
Any questions for Eric? No? Okay. On to Campbell.
Good afternoon. Campbell Ingram, Delta Conservancy. Chair Tatayan and council members, thanks for the opportunity to be here to give you an update. I was a little surprised that it's been a quarter since the last update. Time is flying by. I wanted to just provide updates on two of our grant programs. First, our Proposition 1 grant program. We do ecosystem restoration, water quality, and agricultural sustainability projects with that funding. Yesterday, our board met, and they approved 7 projects requesting $11 million. And so these are a variety of different projects throughout the Delta. Of note, I'm sorry, I wanted to refer you to a table that you have that lists the projects. Yeah. This was actually put out before our board meeting, so this is what the recommendations, but I'll walk through.
And that's in kind of your secondary binder here, the last item, 7C.
So you can see the actual project, who the applicant was, the amount requested. The board approved the top 7 projects. The next 3 actually scored above our threshold of 75 points to be considered, but there was some additional information that we felt we needed before we actually approve those projects. So those projects will come back to the board after we work with the applicants and try to see if we can't move those projects forward as well. So I think of note, the board did approve the almost $8.5 million request for nutria eradication from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. I think that's critical. I think we all agree that we need to hit this issue very hard before we get to that inflection point on the population curve where we could very likely lose control and lose the ability to eradicate. So we are very happy to contribute the $8 million. We've contributed, I think, $1.3 million in previous rounds. Department of Fish and Wildlife has characterized the total ask to about $5 million per year for the next 5 to 7 years. So about $25 to $35 million is what they anticipate spending on trying to eradicate nutria from California. And you can see there our contribution for that as well. Definitely want to thank the Stewardship Council and your staff for participating in the review, because you have an oversight role and the need to determine consistency with the Delta Plan. You don't actually score these projects, but we do run all the projects by staff to make sure that we get Stewardship Council perspective and sort of policy guidance on each of those projects, and it's very helpful in our review process. Projects also are reviewed by a professional review panel, of which one member is Eric Vink. Again, that's a very great opportunity to get some more local perspective. The review panel also includes Department of Fish and Wildlife, DWR, California Department of Food and Ag, State Water Board, and NOAA Fisheries and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. So we get a really broad perspective about the value of these dollars and the ecological benefits that we can create with these dollars. Local support is really critical in our process. We demand that our applicants tell us how are they reaching out to the local communities. Tell us how you're working with the communities, how you're garnering support. We request that they provide support letters, a support letter from the county, and potentially including a resolution from the county. You get extra points if you actually have a county resolution. And then we notify over 100 entities in the Delta, all the county, local, community groups, reclamation districts, RCDs. So the idea is everybody knows these projects are happening. They get a chance to comment on them. The applicants are working with them, and we have local support. So in summary, through the first three cycles, we've put 19 projects on the ground, about $24 million, and that's affecting about 6,400 acres. With this latest tranche, we're up to 26 projects, about $35 million, and affecting about 8,000 acres in the Delta. So we're really proud of those numbers, proud of the partnerships that it takes to make that happen. But one more point I want to make, restoration can be done in the Delta with local support. I think it's really important to note that these projects, all 35 of them, have been unanimously approved by five county supervisors as well as all of the other electeds on our board. So I think that's really important when we think about upcoming targets within the Delta Plan, as when Chapter 4 is revised, as well as voluntary settlement agreements as they move forward. I think the Conservancy has created a space and a model for how you can do restoration with local support. Arguably, we're not doing the great big tidal restoration projects, but still I think the model works, and it's an important way to move forward. Quickly, I'll touch on Prop 68. We have $12 million under Prop 68. It is, interestingly for the conservancies, it is authorized for all of our legislative purposes. So our mandate is to be a lead for restoration and do economic development. We have never had any funding for economic development. So we're going to direct all of this funding towards community and economic development, Delta as Place type projects. So again, it's an exciting time for us to actually have money to try to help the overall economy of the Delta. We have hired staff. We're currently developing guidelines. We envision this to be a little more of a directed open solicitation process, which allows us to be a little more strategic and is allowed within the bond. So we're excited about that. Starting community outreach currently. So we want to go out to as many people in the Delta as possible, let them know how we expect to run the program, what types of projects we hope to fund, get their input, have them help us develop those guidelines. And of course, we would expect to work very closely with Stewardship Council and the Delta Protection Commission to help formulate the program, help bring us concept and proposal ideas, and then hopefully help us review those proposals when we get them to ensure that we're making wise investments of those funds. anticipate a draft of the guidelines out in the fall. We'll have to do three public workshops, and then we would expect to open that solicitation beginning in 2020. So that is the bulk of what we've been up to the last since the last quarter. And again, thank you for the opportunity. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Campbell?
Campbell, I can remember when you didn't have any money.
So can I.
That must feel a lot better now. For those that are earnestly desiring large-scale restoration projects, can you offer any hope or thoughts about how the patchwork of projects that have been approved and are in the process will contribute to knitting together a region or that they will contribute to a large scale approach? Is there a region in the Delta where you see something like that evolving?
Well, I guess I would have to say that I see it evolving in certainly in the kind of Northeast Delta and in the Cache-Lieu complex. I think just by the way that we're structured and the way our funding sources are, we have a lot of projects working out on the landscape that I think arguably add up to something significant. I certainly recognize the need to get large-scale restoration projects on the landscape, but I also think that, you know, the system is hurting from 1,000 different elements. So working on the landscape as we are now, I think, is truly valuable. I think at this point, it's important for us to be able to sort of articulate how that collection of activities provides value to our region and try to articulate what progress we're actually making towards our overarching objectives. But there still absolutely is the need to put some fairly large-scale projects on the landscape, and it needs to be a focus.
Any other questions for Campbell? No?
Okay. All right. With that, I conclude my executive officer's report. Thank you very much.
Any public comment? Nope. Okay. On to item 9, lead scientist report.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. And I wanted to just follow up on a few items that were just mentioned. So Jessica Pearson mentioned State Scientist Day. I think that really was a real contribution. Staff, not just from the science program, but from the whole council participated. I went over and saw the event, and there were thousands of school kids there, really excited and interested and engaged. So I think it really was a successful effort. And then I also wanted to follow up on Campbell mentioned their funding for nutria eradication for CDFW. And on the bad news side, nutria have moved farther into the Delta. So just a couple weeks ago or a week ago, I think a week and a half ago, there was a nutria that was filmed in Stockton, so 16 miles north of where they had been seen previously. And so right near the Stockton Wastewater Treatment Facility and Rough and Ready Island, there were nutria detected, so they have moved further into the Delta. And so I think it really highlights the need for immediate response. And I think that the funds that Campbell mentioned, as well as funds that CDFW has requested through a budget change proposal, hopefully will be able to be made available quickly, and we'll be able to increase the number of people that are out there working towards eradication. I also wanted to mention, yesterday we had a really excellent brown bag we're having a brown bag series on Bay Delta connections, really thinking not just about the Delta, but the Delta in the context of the whole estuary and watershed. And so as our first speaker on that series, we had a guest, Rich Batuque, from recently retired from EPA from their Chesapeake Bay program. He worked on the Chesapeake Bay program for over 30 years. He's their lead on science issues within the Chesapeake Bay program, and he offered a number of really valuable lessons. He came not just for the brown bag, but he was here for a day and a half to meet with staff from the council as well as staff from other agencies. And I'll provide there'll be a summary in next month's report and much more detail, but I think that was really useful. And then the second seminar in that series is coming up June 25th. Stephanie Fong from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and IEP will be presenting thinking, and the whole series, as I said, is around Bay Delta connections with a focus particularly on water quality issues. So that's Stephanie's area of expertise, and she'll be presenting around that. Then another upcoming event, June 11th, there's a bike ride across the state, multi-day, I think it's a 17-day bike ride focus that UCLA is putting together, focusing on climate change issues and particularly on coastal issues around climate change. And so they're going to spend a day in the Delta, and our staff from the council, there's many bike riders here at the council, and so we're going to meet them and do, I think, a 38 or 40-mile bike ride around from Rio Vista up through the lower part of the Delta, and talk about all the challenging issues around climate change for the Delta. So if anyone wants to go on a ride, June 11th, come join us.
I was with you until I found out it wasn't a motorcycle.
You could be our lead. Okay, and then I also wanted to let you know, last month we spent a lot of time talking about the solicitation and the proposals that were reviewed and that you endorsed and approved. CDFW also has approved their funding, and so they funded 11 proposals for a little over $7 million for research in the Delta, and I'll send you a list of their topics so you can see they're a wide range with a similar focus to what we chose, and so I'll send you that list. Any questions on any of those items? Okay, so then on to the items that are in your binder. There's a paper that I wanted to summarize. The paper is Diets of Largemouth Bass in the Sacramento-San Joaquin Delta. That's by Kelly Wienersmith at UC Davis with a number of other co-authors, including two Delta Science Fellows, Denise Colombano and Matthew Young, and Louise Conrad, the Deputy Executive here for Science. She did this work when she was at DWR. And so the focus of this work, as you can guess, is around predatory fish issues. So a number of questions have come up about the importance of predators. And this was work that was done to evaluate how big of an effect largemouth bass are having on native fish populations. And so this work that they did, they looked at over 33 areas within the Delta. They looked at 3,000 fish. They not only looked at the fish, but they looked at the gut content of the fish. So to understand what they're eating, they either, for the smaller fish that are killed, they just extract the gut and then put the gut contents under a dissecting scope and identify the fragments of what they've been eating. The bigger fish, they actually sample them without killing them, and they flush out their stomach. I give them sort of a, you know, yeah. It's after lunch, so. So, yeah, they look at what those fish, and the bigger fish were, the small fish were less than about 7 inches, the bigger fish larger than 7 inches. So 3,000 fish over about 3 years. They caught them by electrofishing, and they intentionally were sampling in shallow areas because that's where shallow areas and a lot of areas where there's dense aquatic vegetation. So they really wanted to see that's really where the largemouth bass spend a lot of their time. Previous samples that have looked at the largemouth bass have been more in the open water areas, and so of course where they spend their time is going to affect what they're eating. What they found, so they were looking at, you know, are they affecting Delta smelt? Are they affecting salmon? Are they affecting other fish of that were part of the pelagic organism decline or that have had significant changes? What they found was that, in fact, they aren't eating salmon and they aren't eating Delta smelt. So of the 3,000 fish that they looked at, one thing is Delta smelt and salmon aren't spending a lot of time in those shallow areas, in those shallow, densely vegetated areas. So there were only 13 instances where there were fish, where they collected salmon as well as largemouth bass out of the, I don't know how many total samples there were, but clearly hundreds and hundreds. And so only 68 of the 3,000 fish were caught in areas where they also were catching salmon. None of them had salmon in their stomach. So they.
I can't help but ask. The Watermaster indicated that, according to some studies, there was a 2% survivability rate, presumably in dry years.
Yeah, so probably that's much more striped bass. So striped bass are probably a much bigger predator on salmon than the largemouth bass. But so I'll give you the results, and then I'll give you some caveats as well. Mm-hmm. But so the salmon, so they weren't eating salmon. They also weren't eating smelt. There were even fewer instances. There were only two cases where smelt were found in the same locations where the largemouth bass were found. So part of that's a function of smelt are so unusual. You know, they're hardly catching smelt where they're targeting them. And this was sampling in different kinds of locations. So what the largemouth bass were feeding on, the small fish are feeding on mostly invertebrates, amphipods, and copepods, and then insects, flies and damselflies and other things. The bigger fish are eating mostly invasive red swamp crayfish or crawfish, and then other non-native fish. So they're eating each other, yes. So they're eating each other, and they're eating sunfish, other similar related fish like sunfish and crappie. So from their data, there isn't a strong case that they're having a significant effect on the native fish. What they do highlight is that in areas where the native fish are more where they are co-occurring, they clearly they're not selectively, you know, that selective in what they're preying upon. So they clearly could be having an effect in areas where there's higher densities of native fish. So there is a possibility that there could be some of those impacts occurring. So, any questions on those on that article?
So, kind of build on Randy's question. So, if the striped bass are the main predator of salmon, where are they taking that salmon? Are they taking them in a different location, or is it in more open water?
Probably more open water.
Because I thought the best strategy for evading predation is create those weedy locations to hide in, but then you've got the
one of the recommendations
sitting there.
Yeah, one of the recommendations in the article is to as we think more about as we're doing more restoration, to really think about the fine scale characteristics, so water temperature issues, turbidity, and those kinds of characteristics, in addition to just vegetation. But yeah, so it is, the predation is somewhat of a conundrum. Creating that habitat, we want to create the habitat that's better for the natives and not the non-natives. And it's a fine line because both native and non-native fish are using some of those vegetated areas.
Yeah, because you can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah. Okay, so then the second item I wanted to highlight for you was the recent meeting of the Remote Imagery Collaboration Group, a workshop on remote imagery collaboration. And you heard earlier this morning about Andrew talking about the need for developing new technologies and using technology more effectively. You also heard from Michael George about the use of remote sensing on evapotranspiration. So remote sensing clearly is a tool that we're all using, but we need to be thinking about how we can use it more effectively. And so this collaboration workshop was actually instigated by Amanda Wasserman, a Sea Grant fellow who just finished recently, and as part of her project here, put together this workshop building on recommendations from other staff, both here and from other agencies, that, you know, we're all working on remote sensing, but we shouldn't be doing that all independently. And especially in terms of buying the images, putting money into the images, we shouldn't be buying the same images. So the workshop was an effort to bring together everyone who's working on these issues across the Delta and to identify how we can collaborate to save resources in terms of accumulating that data or buying that data, and then also how we can learn from each other, so how we could share knowledge around those issues. And I think it was a very effective workshop. That was their first meeting, and there'll be follow-up meetings in the coming months to build on that. And the idea is just to inform each other and to work collaboratively around this topic. And then the second item I wanted to highlight was another workshop. This was the Sacramento River Science Workshop. And again, this was actually the first workshop for this group. The Sacramento River Science Collaborative is a partnership that is just recently formed. It includes the Bureau of Reclamation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, NOAA, the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Sacramento Settlement Contractors. And in some ways, it's analogous to the CSAMP effort within the Delta to bring together the regulated community as well as the regulators to think about how do we use science effectively, in this case, on the Sacramento River. So this workshop was held in April. There were about 80 people that attended, so definitely a lot of interest and awareness. It was right next door at the library. And the focus at the workshop was really just to let people know about this partnership and to think about what kinds of activities the partnership could make some advances in. The discussions focused around monitoring efforts, coordinating restoration efforts, and coordinating modeling efforts. And the group is, they just are working on a charter right now that is being agreed upon amongst those founding agencies and partners, and they're also working on developing a work plan that will identify the activities that they'll be doing over the next year or two. Any questions on either of those workshops?
Ken, you look like you have a question on the workshop.
Yeah, it's not on that. It's just I've been following the council's Twitter account, and I got to say, staff's doing a great job in that. It sort of distracts me from the more depressing, toxic stuff on Twitter. But the whole sort of, I'm not going to call it a rebound, but the larger numbers in winter run salmon, you know, we've put that out there and I've seen some others. And you know, is there any meaning in that? Or is that just, you know, is this a good baseline to CG the effect of having such a wet year on the winter run, and I don't know what it means to the food web, that kind of thing, or is there something you can tell us, you know, is that, since we've had a lot of bad news,
I think it's primarily recovery from the drought, so 2017 okay. being a relatively wet year, that the population is responding more to conditions when they were juveniles moving out. And actually what I saw as well on the winter run was that some of the first year fish were coming back with an indication that next year may actually be a reasonably good year or even better year. And so I think it is, you know, it is, and also recovery of salmon on the San Joaquin is another strong indication. So I think we are making progress in those areas. It is a function of both the environmental conditions as well as restoration efforts. I think to see a really strong signal, we can't just look at one year because you've seen any population trend where there's so much variation. But as we move out over 3 to 4 to 5 years, and we might start to see a much more reliable trend.
Are you seeing anything in ocean conditions that contributed to the larger numbers, the returns?
This year's ocean conditions are not very good, so I'm not sure about last year's ocean conditions. But right now, you've probably also seen the stories of how many whales have been stranded. So it definitely is a function of ocean conditions as well.
But if the number's higher,
It's more likely reflecting previous conditions than, you know, this year's run is more a function of how they did over their lifespan than exactly what's happening now.
Okay. Thank you.
But yeah, I think it is good news, better news than the opposite.
Any other questions for John? No. Any questions from the public? All right, then. Our next meeting will be June 27 at the Big Break Center in Oakley. Looking forward to that. And with that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you for coming.